Read this morning that dozens of schools are closing due to a lack of pupils. We may have a look at that a little later in the programme. There's another story. This time it involves people here illegally who are working, where the government is making enormous progress, but we wonder whether it matters, because the people that they are seeking to mollify or appeal to are not necessarily rational. Who else is thinking at this point of Telford Tamara? You had to be there yesterday. But we will begin with the Workers' Rights Bill and one or two elements of it that are almost mind-bogglingly bad. Unless, of course, I'm missing something.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, Hurricane Melissa has reached Cuba after leaving what's been declared a disaster area in Jamaica. The world's strongest storm of the year so far brought winds of 185 miles per hour to the island. Siobhan Brown is in the north coast port of Ocho Rios. He is one of hundreds of thousands of people without power.
There's currently no water as well, and that's, of course, because of the storm surge and the water. So it had to be cut just to protect individuals. Electricity is also out. I know that the government had brought in external partners to assist with reconnecting the island immediately.
Officials in the capital, Kingston, have warned people to watch out for crocodiles that may have been displaced by flash flooding. A sex offender freed from prison by mistake is now back in Ethiopia. The Home Office has confirmed Hadish Kabatu has been deported after he was arrested in North London on Sunday. A Home Office minister has told LBC that asylum seekers could be moved to military barracks as soon as next month. There are plans to use sites in Inverness and East Sussex to house about 900 people awaiting immigration decisions. It's part of a commitment to end the use of migrant hotels. The Border Security Minister, Alex Norris, has pushed back against reports of delays to the plans.
We're intending to have people on site by the end of November. You know, we need to make sure the sites are safe, both on site and for the immediate community, and that's what we'll be doing. But let's remember the goal that we're in service of here. We inherited this situation where hotels up and down this country are being used to this purpose, all the economic impact that has, all the impact that has on the community. We are going to close every single one of those hotels.
Dozens of people are reported dead after a series of Israeli strikes in Gaza. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, ordered the attacks after accusing Hamas of killing a soldier and staging the recovery of a hostage. Hamas has rejected the claims. Economists and academics have warned the two-child benefit cap is causing long-term economic damage. A letter to Rachel Reeves from 40 leading figures and seen by LBC says the limit must be overturned in the budget next month. The government says it's drawing up an ambitious strategy to tackle child poverty. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading up 41 points at 97.41. The pound buys $1.32 and a euro 13. LBC weather, most places seeing some sunshine and showers, but strong winds and some heavier rain further north, a high of 14 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
In 2024, a hangry fan posted, "Why do other countries have better McDonald's menus than ours?" So, we went abroad and heisted some worldwide favourites. The World Menu Heist. 9 of the most wanted McDonald's menu items from around the world. Now in the UK. Until 25th of November from 11 a.m. Fees apply to delivery orders. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Minutes after 10. Do you know one of the daftest things I can do at the top of the show? Good morning, by the way. I hope you're well. It is to refer to a few stories that I am not actually going to invite you to ring in about. But guess what I'm about to do? A few things in the news today that tickle my sort of ivories. The first is a story very like yesterday's. If you weren't listening yesterday, we took a call from a lovely lady in Telford. You could tell she was lovely because she described herself as disagreeing with me on many, many subjects. But she represents a brand of conservatism that is completely unrepresented in British democracy at the moment. In fact, she represents a political perspective that is completely unrepresented in British politics at the moment. And if you think, so what? It's just one woman in Telford. It's also a political perspective occupied by, off the top of my head, Sir John Major and Lord Heseltine. You know, two of the most significant conservatives of our lifetimes, whether you like them or not. I kind of like both of them. Heseltine more than Major. Major is one of those politicians. It's a nice word. One of those politicians who, whose reputation has been enhanced by not being in office. Something that is yet to happen to Liz Truss, of whom more later. But I'm obsessed with that constituency of what you might call decent Tories, or Tories who are, may well be concerned about some elements of the immigration situation, but they are not absolutely obsessed with it to the point of Sarah Poachin or indeed Robert Jenrick style racism. And I kind of find myself wondering about what the current government's policies in that particular area will achieve and who they will appeal to. So yesterday it was the hotels. Today we learn it may not actually save any money, but it's designed to quell public disquiet. And there's another story about the absolute plummeting, or rather the huge rise, an incredible rise, in the arrests of people working illegally in the UK while their applications are being processed. So if you have legitimate concerns about these issues, and in fact that was one of the things that Telford Tamara picked up on yesterday, then you should actually be celebrating on that very specific metric, that very specific statistic. And I think the future, the next round, the next cycle of UK politics will depend upon just how many people actually have, quote, legitimate concerns, and how many are nativist bigots, like Sarah Poachin and Robert Jenrick, and of course all the other people that trip so easily off your tongue when we open up conversations like this. But we're not going to talk about that first, and we're not going to talk about the schools either, because, well, I can't make head nor tail of this story. It's nationwide, it's up and down the country, it's only 38 schools at the moment, but it seems completely at odds with everything that we're constantly being told, that they're shutting primary schools because of a shortage of pupils. We may get onto that a little later in the programme. Oh, and one other thing on the hotel story. The companies contracted by the Home Office to provide asylum accommodation are on course for another record-breaking year of profits. So it's not all bad news. The companies contracted by the Home Office under previous governments, we must be reminded, are on course for another record-breaking year of profits. Hurrah! I wonder what parties they have historically donated most money to and what on earth they got in return. Cronies, VIP lanes, etc, etc, etc. One of the many casualties of conversations that are dedicated to immigration and culture wars and all the rest of it is that we lose sight of the stuff that affects us most. It's a funny thing to reflect upon, that the stuff that affects us most. I use us a little loosely because I'm not affected by 0 hours contracts or indeed by anything that is in the employment rights bill that Angela Rayner championed and which is currently being steered through Parliament with a limited success. I'll explain more in a moment. But the stuff that directly affects us, for example, income tax increases, which I hope are coming. There you go. You can chisel that on a headstone and stick it in your garden. I hope income tax rises are coming, even though they will leave me worse off, because we need them. The country needs to slightly rebalance the distribution of taxation as well as the distribution of wealth. And it just needs recognition that when times are hard, you have to dig deep. So that's on the way as well. That affects us directly, and we don't really talk about it as much as perhaps we should. You look at the front pages, you look at news coverage, and you don't see much about the workers' rights bill, or as they call it, the employment rights bill. And I don't know what that says. It's a bit dry. You can't use it to whip up hatred against anybody except trade unions, and that all feels a little bit 1980s at the moment, although these things always come back round again. Still waiting for single mothers to be in the firing line, although it may be that social change and demographic change has finally let them off the hook of the tabloid Tory alliance. But I'm intrigued by the House of Lords rejecting the government's employment rights bill on two particular fronts. I'm intrigued by them opposing Labour's move to force employers to offer guaranteed hours to employees from day one. Listen, I've said it's dry, but it's my job to make it not dry. I nearly said wet then, but that would have been weird. It's my job to make it not dry. That's really important. I want you to imagine that you're starting a job and you don't know how many hours you're going to work. I can't quite get my head around about how you steer the ship at moments like that. How do you do it? If you don't know how many hours you're going to work. I was in a restaurant. I told you this. It wasn't a very posh place. It was one of those noodle bars in Soho. And it was quiet. It was quite quiet. It's a chain. I looked it up, actually. It's backed by Venture Capital. And there were four lads in the kitchen. And the manageress came over and just sent two of them home. I told you this at the time. And you were a lot less shocked by it than I was, which, of course, is part of the problem of not being directly involved in these kind of phenomena. She just sent two of them home. And you could see, actually, for the record, one of them seemed quite relaxed about it, but one of them was really gutted. How do you budget? If, even when you get to work, the boss has the right to say, oh, sorry, we don't need you after all. You can go home now. I've referred many times. I can't actually find it, but of course we can put the hive mind on the case. There was a lovely little strip. Viz Magazine did a lot on 0 hours contracts. They had full, you know, page long comic strips, but it was a short one. It was a 3 or 4 panel one that really resonated with me. And I forget the name of Barney Farmer and Lee someone with a double act that did the cartoon. And it just had a very poignant and powerful narrative of a lad on his way to work, and but just before he got there being told not to bother coming in and go home again because he was on a 0 hours contract. And what I want is to know what that's like today. 0345 60 60 973. There's two topics I'm going to try and get up and running because they are very much the same. They're part of the same bill, and they are quite different questions. So it's do you see what I mean? It's sort of two things, which again, just like beginning the program with reference to stories that we're not going to talk about later, is not necessarily the best way of doing this job, but it's how I want to do it today. I want you to tell me first and foremost what it's like not knowing the hours you're going to work. And it's a minimum. So, Tom, it's not like being a frontline police officer. You've got a guaranteed amount of work, but you might be called upon to do more. This is starting at zero, mate. There are no 0 hours. Well, listen, he says with enormous confidence, setting himself up for a moment of embarrassment. I'm pretty confident that there are no 0 hours police officers who some weeks don't earn any money at all because the boss has decided or the custody sergeant has decided he doesn't need any bodies in the station. I just want to know the reality of this. And from that, we can leap to the question of whether or not the Lords and indeed the Tories are right to keep sending it back to the Commons. They voted by 302 votes to 159 in favour of an amendment that would oppose Labour's move to force employers to offer guaranteed hours to employees from day one. It's a bit nuanced, this, because if you are an employer, I want you to tell me why this isn't as bad as it initially sounds. I'm a bit of an idiot when it comes to votes like this. You know, the government should have an easy-ish majority in the Lords on a lot of things. So the fact that peers, who generally study things a little bit more closely than their compadres in the Commons, are rejecting it with a majority of 143 suggests to me that it is not a simple issue. If you see it from one end of the telescope, it must be absolutely outrageous to be told on your way to work that you're not needed today, so you have to go home and earn next to nothing, whatever it is you'd get on universal credit for another day when you're not working but want to. It limits what you can do. You can hardly have three plates spinning, can you, at the same time? You can hardly have three different employers all on 0 hours contracts, and one says you're not working today, and so you hope that the other one says you does. Because what if they both say you can today, we need you today, and you have to tell one of them you can't, which means you're not going to get a shift tomorrow? I would think, you know, coming at it from a position of relative ignorance. So what is that like, that 0 hours contract? And therefore, what do we think of the government's plans to force employers to guarantee a number of hours? Something in those words make me think there might be a little bit more to it than meets the eye. Why would it be for you a problem to guarantee hours to employees from day one? Now, the second bit of the question today involves something that I got very, very cross about when David Cameron did it. So when I started doing this job, or certainly at the time that I can most recently remember, you had very few rights at work when it came to dismissal if you had been in the job for less than a year. Okay? If after a month the new employer decided that this wasn't a very good fit, you could be handed your sandwiches, a very small number of sandwiches wrapped in a very small roadmap. If after 9 months you were determined not to be a good fit or things had changed at the business, then your employer could get rid of you, could say goodbye, thank you, sayonara and good night without having to compensate you in any way. I mean, a little bit uncomfortably, if you'd been in a job for 364 days and the very next day you were due to get whatever rights the permanent workforce got, yeah, in terms of holiday pay, sickness pay, maybe even some pension contributions, you could be fired without any compensation at all. David Cameron came into power. I remember this. So I really puzzled over it at the time and immediately raised it to 2 years. So you could be in a job for 365 plus 364? It ends in 9. 729, is it? 729, there you go, LSE. 729 days and you could be fired on day 728. And no, on day 729 and not get any compensation whatsoever. And I thought that at the time that that was horrible, but perfectly reasonable people pointed out to me I'd never been an employer, and therefore I didn't know the difficulties and the complications of dealing with some of these factors. I don't even know if you know this, but Angela Rayner's bill would reduce that from 2 years to 1 day. So I find myself in the slightly unfamiliar and very uncomfortable position of thinking that a policy decision designed to protect workers is bloody stupid. How on earth, if I turn up at day one and I spend the entire day scratching my backside and picking my nose, very unhygienic, by the way, pick one, how on earth can I have any right to compensation if the employer tells me not to bother coming in tomorrow? Unless I'm missing something rather huge here, this is a really, really silly policy. And, of course, my anecdote, I always have an anecdote ready for you. I've got a cracker coming up later. You're never going to guess what it is. It's linked to the announcement we've made this morning about the Olympics, about the Team GB at the Olympics, and me, my personal involvement in an Olympics team. If anyone can remember that anecdote, because I've almost certainly told it before, I'll give them the money myself. The hairdresser friend of mine who offered an apprenticeship to a young lady, and she said, oh, well, there will be some days when I can't come in at very short notice. And he said, why? And he said, because my neighbours have just got a new kitten and I might have to look after it sometimes. And it's true. That's why I mention it. Just like the woman in the bloody jewellery room at Crown Court when I was doing jewellery service. These stories that I sort of happen into, stumble into off air, sometimes have a resonance for me that I can't wait to bring on air. And that was another one. So imagine if she didn't tell you that. You gave her a job. Day two, day three, day 10, she phones you at 6 o'clock in the morning and says, I won't be in today, boss. And you say, why not? And she says, well, my neighbours have got a new kitten and I have to look after it at short notice. At which point you'll say, well, is this ever going to happen again? And she says, well, yes, probably. And at that point, if you said, well, I don't think this is going to work, I think we should probably cut our losses and move on. You owe me a lot of money, or you owe me a significant amount, you owe me some money. So there are two elements to this. It's unfair dismissal. That would be the argument. But of course, you'd have to go to tribunal, you'd have to do all sorts of things to prove that the dismissal had been unfair. But to do it on day one seems to me to be a fairly ridiculous proposal. Do you agree? 0345 6060973. I'd love to know what employers think about that. The idea that you would not be able to dismiss... So you wouldn't be able to bring an unfair dismissal claim. That's the point, to claim that you'd been dismissed unfairly. And then the second question is, what is it like to be on a 0 hours contract? So how long? I would say 6 months. And oddly, the Resolution Foundation agrees. It was a year under the last Labour government that you could work in a job without being able to bring an unfair dismissal claim. So, I mean, the downside of it is, as I'm sure you're about to point out to me, that if you were genuinely and obviously dismissed unfairly, if you were dismissed because you turned down the romantic approaches of the boss, or you were dismissed because he wanted to replace you with his mistress, or you were dismissed because she didn't like the colour of your eyeshadow, then you would not be able to complain. So you have no rights whatsoever for 2 years. You cannot be dismissed unfairly. You cannot bring an unfair dismissal claim. At the moment, it's 2 years. Under the last Labour government, it was 1 year. And under the current Labour government, it's set to be 0 years. 0 months, 0 weeks, 0 days. 0 hours, if you want to tie the two topics together. How can that be right? Tell me what I'm missing on 0345 60 60 973. And tell me, even if you think everybody knows, because I promise you they don't, what is it like to be on a so-called 0 hours contract? And how do you greet the possibility that an employer would have to guarantee a certain number of hours a week as either an employer or an employee? There's something I really don't like. I won't take long. I'm late for the break. I don't like the way that right-wing media, and as we highlighted perfectly yesterday, dedicated entirely to the protection of the interests of wealth. I'm going to be hitting you over the head with that for a long time to come, because everybody seems to have forgotten that's why they exist, whether they're on the radio, newspapers, television, working for stink tanks surrounding Tufton Street, whatever it is, these huge armies of influencers and opinion formers exist entirely to protect the interests of epic wealth. So when you talk about minimum wage, when you talk about 0 hours contracts, when you talk about employment rights, the noise, the narrative is dominated by people say, oh, employers can't afford it, employers can't wear it. Now, sometimes that will be true, but you hardly ever hear the voices from the other side saying, what about the workers? That's how I want to conduct this conversation today. 0345 60 60 973. And the reason why your sandwiches are wrapped in a roadmap when you are given your marching orders from a job is so that you can find your way home. It's 10:21.
LBC.
At Harwoods, we know your car says a lot about you. Maybe that you like to make an entrance, or you'd rather make your escape. That you want to cut a dash, or just cut your emissions. That you like to take the bends or bring your four-legged friends. Whatever, we speak your language. Come and have a chat at Harwood's Audi Crawley and Five Oaks and Harwood's Volvo Crawley. Details at harwoods.co.uk. Harwood's, family-owned since 1931.
Have you found peace?
No. I don't think that I will ever completely be at peace.
I don't want to live with this trauma anymore.
For many veterans, their battles continue after service. Help for Heroes stands with them every day, providing life-changing support that rebuilds lives. It's not just their fight, it's ours too. Together, we must help veterans find the peace they deserve. Search Help for Heroes today.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 60 60 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
22 minutes after 10 is the time. And the argument will always be, oh, if you make me do this, then my business will be unviable. If you make me do this, then my business will fail. If I have to pay people a living wage, I won't be able to keep my business afloat. If I have to guarantee hours to my workforce, I won't be able to keep my business afloat. And I'm not quite as dismissive of that as I used to be, because sometimes it will be true. But I do subscribe chiefly to the idea that if that's true, then your business is not viable. Do you see what I mean? Your business is not sustainable if you can't afford to pay people a decent wage or guarantee them a certain amount of work a week. But as you will no doubt be shouting at the radio, what the hell do I know? James is in Aberdeen. James, what do you know?
Hi, James. Thanks for having me on. It's one of the things. I've been in the offshore industry for approximately 13 years now, and I have never had a guaranteed income in those 13 years. I'm currently sitting on what can be described as a 0 hours contract. At the moment, I've been at home for the past 4 weeks since my last job finished.
What, waiting for the phone to ring?
Yep.
I let me get my own preconceptions out of the way. Offshore work is generally pretty well rewarded, right?
It is.
Okay, but you would still rather have foreknowledge of how much work you were going to have over a 6 month or 12 month period.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, the thing is, one of the big problems is offshore work as well, especially in the sector that I work in, which is subsea robotics.
That's sexy. Say that again.
Subsea robotics.
Subsea robotics. Carry on. Carry on.
Anyway, we work very seasonally because come this time of year, leading through the winter and into early spring, we have big storms, as you well know.
Right.
And it restricts how much work can actually be done offshore.
So the employer would say there isn't any work in December, so how can I keep James on the payroll?
Exactly. But they can also turn around and say, well, we make X amount of work, we've got, we can at least pay a retainer salary, say 120 days out of that.
This isn't going to be in the employment rights bill. What is going to be in the employment rights bill? This isn't going the way that you thought it would, I don't think, mate. Because,
well, I don't know. I mean,
no, hang on. Let me tell you why. I'm kind of thinking. At the moment, the bill would force your employer to give you a fixed number of hours, and all they'll do, I imagine, is guarantee the lowest allowable figure, and it won't make any measurable difference to your life at all.
It may not. I don't know. Like I said to your producer when I was speaking to her, I don't know the full ins and outs of the bill, but I am hoping that it is at least going to give those of us that live relatively unstably some form of security to look ahead in the future.
I think it probably won't to people who are quite well rewarded and the problem is seasonal. I imagine they'll bring in that guaranteed hours will be too low to make a big difference. And again, if the detail is available, we'll find it and share it. Sorry to change the subject, but tell me a bit about subsea robotics.
We basically do things that, whether the water's too deep for divers to get in and do the job, or too heavy as well. So we'll do construction of remote subsea oil fields. We'll do a lot of work to do with renewables as well, like.
You stay above that. You stay out of the water with a kind of joystick.
Yeah, basically.
That's pretty cool. Are you good at video games?
Oh, no. I'm terrible at them.
I thought you would be. 26, I bet you could fly a drone. 26 minutes after 10 is the time. I don't know. Before you go, are you technically a contractor?
No, I'm an employee.
So you are. You're an employee on a zero-hours contract. So if you took work from somebody else and then the phone rang and said, we need you tomorrow, you'd be in a hot spot. You'd be in a spot of bother.
Yeah, we're contractually obliged not to work for anyone else.
Yeah, okay. I'm glad I clarified that because that's not fair. Is it? I mean, it's like everything's weighted in the employer's favour, is that I've got the right to tell you you're not allowed to work for anybody else, but I've also got the right to tell you that you're not working for me today. Just pause for a minute, all right? And that's someone who is relatively well rewarded when he has got work. I don't know. I mean, you talk to me about how productivity needs to increase. Growth is in the doldrums. Therefore, we need to give more rights to employers or wealth creators, as people sometimes like to call them. But how much power? So you're not allowed to work for anybody else. You're only allowed to work for me. Oh, but you're not working for me today. That just offends me on a moral level. And I don't know whether it should or not, but it does. Tomas is in Worcester. Tomas, what would you like to say?
Morning, James. Hello, so happy Tomas. To speak to you again.
Likewise. What's going on?
Right. So I have two words that you absolutely need to include in this conversation, and that would be employment agencies.
Okay.
That's a massive sector that I quickly Googled to prep for the conversation.
Good.
And it actually employs around 200,000 people in the UK.
Okay.
And being on the receiving end on the 0 hours contract of employment agencies, I cannot stress how exploitative and hurtful they are to people. Let me give you one example, okay?
Yes.
Going back to COVID days, you remember these happy days when all of us were supposed to sit at home on furlough and 80% income?
Well, you were. I wasn't, well, but yes, I do.
Yes, I used that time to volunteer for a charity, but then again, a lot of my community friends...
Lovely thing to do, go on.
Well, but be sitting at home doing nothing.
No, I get it. I've just given you a bit of credit for doing such a decent thing.
Thank you very much indeed. So a lot of my community friends who have been in employment agencies on 0 hours contract have received nada.
Of course.
They could have been working for 6 months for an employment agency on a full-time based on 0 hours contract, but they just have not received a single penny for it. And even more than that, I actually see a 0 hour contract as a very unfair practice because it basically transfers the risk of running the business
to the employee.
To the employee.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think that James in Aberdeen nailed that down in ways that people may have been slightly surprised by. How do you live not knowing how much you're going to earn each month?
Well, you essentially don't live, you vegetate, I would say, because you literally sit by the phone. You cannot plan anything, forget about any career progression, any plans, holidays, etc. Look, my first year in the UK, I was on 0 hours contracts for agencies.
Yes.
And I was registered with four of them.
Right.
To have at least a minimum of guarantee. So I was simultaneously a van driver, warehouse operator, and a cleaner.
So the agency is spinning the plates in a way that you probably wouldn't be able to, because they've got a big enough pool of labour to say, well, actually, no, we can give you 10 people today. And we can give them 10 people today, but you wouldn't be able to do that individually, because if they both rang, if the van driver company and the cleaning company rang you on the same day, you'd have to let one of them down, which means you probably wouldn't get a shift next week.
100%. Oh, and that's like, you know, you get a bad rep in 4 or 5 agencies. So it's not like you can make a steady living out of that. You just slowly crumble out of this, and it's just not sustainable in the long run.
So, what do we think working on the fear that I'm not going to get the callers to tell me? I hope I will. I haven't had a proper look at the screen. But what would the argument in favour of this be? What would the employer say, that I can't run my business if I have to shoulder the risk myself, really, is what they would say.
Thomas. I am an employer right now.
Okay.
We do employ people in our charity. Thank you.
Yes.
But I have been faced with a tough choice of not being able to pay two of my employees a national living wage, which is the absolute minimum for me in the business.
Right.
So unfortunately, we sat down, we had a conversation. I said, look, sorry, I cannot really employ you anymore.
Yeah.
And then I referred them to colleagues from the industry who are doing better than us, and I helped them get a new job.
But what would they prefer? If they said, I could give you a 0 hours contract, but I won't be, but then it's a Dutch auction, isn't it? It's like saying, well, sorry, I can only offer you a 0 hours contract.
James,
it's better than nothing.
I've been so traumatized by 0 hours contract that I would rather shut down my business than offer somebody that.
That's fascinating. It's really, really interesting. And you know my job, Thomas. I have to now ask people to ring in and tell us why things aren't as bleak and as awful as James and Thomas have depicted, because a plurality of voters in the House of Lords have sent this proposal back to the House of Commons. Before I go, when's the last time you went to Shrub Hill Station?
4 months ago, I think.
Isn't that that little waiting room? Isn't that absolutely extraordinary? Do you know the one I mean?
Yeah, I do. But you know what? I've got to be honest. I've seen better train stations.
Oh, mate, the train station is not what anybody would call state of the art or a national treasure. But there are a couple of waiting rooms there. I must have gone through Shrub Hill Station 500 times in my life. I never got off there. But when I'm coming back to London from Kidderminster, I come that way sometimes now, and I pause, I change at Shrub Hill. There are a couple of waiting rooms on the platform at Shrub Hill Station that are absolute works of art. Go and have another look next time you're there.
Yes, they are, but, you know, for me, Shrub Hill only connects to the frustration of waiting for a train to London that got cancelled.
But go and sit in this... Is it Art Deck? What is it? I'm going to look it up. It's a beautiful thing. It's one of the boring things about me as I get older, is I'm really loving things like what you could call ancient urban architecture. I don't know, there's probably a fancy phrase. Trust me on this, Thomas. Stop being a spoilsport. Go and sit in it. Go and have another look. It's absolutely beautiful. From Tomash to Thomas. Thomas Watts with your headlines.
Hurricane Melissa has made landfall in Cuba after hitting Jamaica with winds of 185 miles per hour. Hundreds of thousands of people are without power and communications as a result of catastrophic winds and flash flooding. President Trump has insisted nothing is going to jeopardize the Gaza ceasefire. Israel, which has accused Hamas of targeting IDF troops, has continued a series of airstrikes overnight. More than 40 economists and policy experts have urged Rachel Reeves to scrap the two-child benefit cap. A letter seen by LBC says child poverty is causing long-term economic damage and the policy must be overturned in the budget. LBC weather, sunshine and showers for many places, strong winds and occasionally heavy rain further north. A high of 14 degrees.
This is LBC.
This is what award-winning customer service sounds like. from Real Octopus Energy calls.
The people are friendly on the telephone. You can always get a problem solved.
You stepped it up, I think, for an energy company, so well done.
The customer service is really good.
People like yourself and all of your colleagues have done such a wonderful job.
Your customer service was tip-top, you know, I couldn't fault it.
Octopus Energy, great value and outstanding customer service, recommended by Which? 8 years running.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.5% AER variable. That includes a 2% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
Oh yeah, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that safari, luxury cruise or relaxing retreat. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents. Available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.41% gross. Terms apply.
Lost World Play Barn. Dragon Castle Children's Farm. Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Froggy Soft Play. Tommy Tractor Play Barn. Quaterpillar Rowing Boats. Owl Displays, Meerkats, Honey Pot Bears. And four giant slides on the brand new Waverunner 2. Let's plunge!
What's next, Dad?
Cannon Arena Lemurs, Jungle Kingdom Go-Karts, Trampolines, Magical Wood and Cafes!
Nutcatch Adventure Park!
The fun goes on and on and on and on!
Book now at nutcatch.com! Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
It is 10:35 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. The measures set out in the bill will require employers to offer eligible workers guaranteed hours reflecting the hours they regularly work over reference period, which will be set in regulations and is expected to be 12 weeks. So over a 12-week period, you get an offer of guaranteed hours, which you can then reject if you want, if they're asking you to do too much, I suppose, and remain on a 0 hours contract if you wish. So it won't help James in Aberdeen if there are sort of 12-week windows where his admittedly seasonal work is not needed by his employer. But the idea that his employer during that period is entitled to tell him not to work for anybody else, here's a real interesting illustration of the difference. I don't know how much James earns, so I'm not putting him necessarily on the other side of this seesaw. But in my line of work, they give you money specifically to stop you working for other people. You can even get it written into your contract. I remember a pal of mine started writing, he's on the Times, but he's self-employed, so he's a freelance he had a column in the Times, and he started doing some work for another magazine, and it was really popular. So the editor called him in and asked him to stop, and he said, no, I'm self-employed. I don't get holiday pay. I don't get sickness pay. I don't get, and so the editor said, all right, I'll give you, I won't tell you how much, cause you'll choke on your muesli, but I'll give you X thousand pounds just to promise that you won't write for anyone else. You have to sign. You don't just make a promise and do it on a handshake, but I will give you tens of thousands of pounds not to write for anybody else. I mean, it makes logical sense. It makes commercial sense. Personally, and he kind of agreed with me about this, I think they were slightly over-egging his appeal. But you're not going to argue, are you? Someone says, here's a check for you to do nothing. Someone is going to pay you to do some work. I'm going to pay you not to do it. That's the kind of contract arrangement I dream of. That's the sort of thing that gets me out of bed in the morning. I'm going to give you £100,000 not to moonlight on, I don't know, GBBs. An unlikely prospect, I grant you. But if you're, if you have a certain employment status, they will give you a lot of money in order to tell you that you're not allowed to work for anybody else. If you have no employment status at all, they don't have to. They don't have to. I mean, you can be on minimum wage and a 0 hours contract with an employer who is allowed to tell you that you're not allowed to work for anybody else. Ah, come on. Defend that if you can. Please give me a ring and defend that. 0345 6060 973. So why do the Lords keep sending it back to the Commons? And I'm not being silly, and I don't think I'm being naive. That means there must be more to it than we are currently establishing, surely. 0345 6060 973. The other element of the conversation, which hasn't, we haven't had time to squeeze it in yet. I should probably shut up and take more calls, but I want you to tell me about the other bit of it, which is unfair dismissal. The idea, and this will probably be employers telling me how absurd it is for somebody to have the right to sue you for unfair dismissal if they've only been in the job for an hour? 03456060973. I don't find any support for this policy. Even the Resolution Foundation, which is a brilliant organisation in defence of ordinary people, workers in particular, society's less well off, suggests 6 months is reasonable. You can be in a job for 6 months and have no right to sue for unfair dismissal. But to be in a job for 6 hours and have a right to sue, what does that do to an employer? It is 10:39. Marco suggests we could all have a whip round to keep you off air. I'd be up for that. It's how much you can raise, mate. If you can beat my current salary to make me stay at home every day, then we could certainly open negotiations. 10:39 is the time. Mark is in Swindon. Mark, what would you like to say?
Well, first thing to say about your friend is I think he should actually be employed, not self-employed, if he's being paid to sit at home and only work for one employer.
Yeah.
That's the first thing I'd say.
I think he'd probably rather be on the staff, because then you get holiday pay, then you get sickness pay, then you get pension, you may even get equity in the company, but they don't want him on the staff for that reason, so it's cheaper.
Well, of course not, because it's a tax fiddle,
It's cheaper for them to pay him to not write for one rival. I should add that it's a rival. So I don't think it stands comparison with many other professions. But on we go.
So I run a hotel bar restaurant in Swindon. We used to offer zero-hour contracts. And as a company, we decided we would get rid of zero-hour contracts. Okay. And then our staff left.
Why?
They like the flexibility. They like to be able to work school-time hours. You know,
yeah, but why can't you guarantee that?
Well, because if I was going to do that, then how could I then take on somebody to employ people at the other hours when they're not available?
Well, you guarantee that as well.
No, I can't.
Why not?
So over
a 12-week period,
yeah,
you know what my shift is. You know I like to pick up the kids from school. Can you guarantee me X number of hours that reflect what I've been doing for you for the last 6 months? I just need it to be guaranteed.
Of course I can.
Well, then you've got nothing to worry about.
Now it's the summer holidays.
Well, and they want, and so you say I'm going
to
guarantee you
be at home. I've just told you school time hours.
So
what's happened?
Yeah, but then they can say no. You don't. You can say I can guarantee it for you, and they can say don't worry, I don't need it.
Exactly, and that's why they left.
No, well, it's one of us is missing something here. It's probably me. So
well. If you look at my industry, James...
Oh, hang on. Someone's just sent me a picture of the Shrub Hill waiting room. It's absolutely gorgeous. I wasn't exaggerating. I shall share that on Blue Sky imminently. So, hang on. I am looking at your industry.
So, if you look at my industry...
Hang on. Let me tell you what I'm confused about. Otherwise, you won't be able to help me. Why can't you tell them that they are guaranteed a certain number of hours over a 12-week period, secure in the knowledge that if they don't want those hours or can't work those hours, they'll tell you at the outset, which gives you plenty of time to find somebody else to do those shifts?
But I can't get somebody else to do those shifts, because if I take on another member of staff, I've then got to guarantee them hours. And when my staff are available for 6 weeks because the kids are at school, I then can't guarantee the other person the hours.
See, I'm not going to challenge you. I'll take what you're saying in good faith. But why are none of those people ringing me?
Well, have you got the right demographic?
Yeah, absolutely I have. I've got 1.4 million listeners. All human life is here. And whenever I do subjects like this, I'll take a call like yours, telling me something that I find, I can see some tensions within it for fairly obvious reasons. It's an employer saying, I can't run my business unless I'm free to demand that people work exclusively for me, even when I can't give them any work.
No, I will just go back to the beginning part where we as a company said that we were no longer going to do 0 hours contracts to support our staff, and then it turns out that what our staff really wanted is the flexibility to be able to work when they're available to work and take off the time that they need to take in order to spend time with their families.
Yeah, but the proposals accommodate that. You can have a term time contract. It's a 12-week reference period that's used to ascertain working patterns. There's all sorts of ways you could accommodate this if you sat down and spoke to them about what would work for both of you.
The problem we've got is I need somebody every day between those hours. And if that person isn't available, I then need to get somebody else, which is not a problem. I'm more than happy to share the workload.
But nobody's going to want you to guarantee hours that they don't want to work.
No, exactly my point. So let's say employee A doesn't want to work for 6 weeks because it's the school holidays. That means I need to get employee B to do it.
Yes.
But if employee B wants to work it, great, for the next 6 weeks, but then she wants work in October as well and November, but employee A wants those hours as well. So I'm now overstaffed in order to cover for the staff which I haven't got.
So what did you do to solve the problem?
After a long period of time, what we've ended up doing is allowing zero-hour contracts again. So right. That we've got full-time members of staff, which have got same amount of hours every week, week in, week out. And then we've also got casuals, which come in and fill the gaps. But what this employment bill will turn around and say is, I can't have the casuals anymore. Even though that's when they want to work. People want to work. In my industry, people work it as a second job. So they might be working Monday to Friday for an insurance broker, and then they come and work in the bar for me for 4 hours on a Saturday to get a bit of extra pin money. And what we're saying is, we can't, with the new employment rights bill, we wouldn't be able to do that because we wouldn't be able to guarantee them 4 hours every Saturday because we're only busy on paydays.
But surely that is something that you can accommodate.
How?
Well, by telling them.
How many pubs are shutting every week, James?
Quite a lot.
Yeah, that's
because people aren't going to them. That's a problem with customers as much.
No, that's
probably
not
more
correct.
Than a problem
people aren't
with
going
staff.
To them all month long. So people are still going to pubs on paydays. People are still going to pubs on holidays.
So what you guarantee doing, them work on the days when you need them, surely?
Exactly. That's fine.
And that's what the contract would do. I'm sure that you're making more sense than I am because you're doing this every day and I'm not. But how did the industry that you're in stay afloat before 0 hours contracts were introduced?
When were 0 hours contracts introduced?
My understanding is
they've always been 0 hours contracts.
No, they haven't.
Certainly throughout my 40 years, we've been able to employ people casually for hours that are required as per the industry.
And what do you think the future would look like? You'd have to guarantee, 6 hours a week to everybody? And if people turned around and said, I don't want them, then your business would be thrown into disarray.
Well, all that's going to end up happening...
Casual work isn't part of this legislation.
But people, you've just said that people want a contract. They
want to
know where they are.
No, you're talking about part-timers. On casual labour. And I'm talking about people who want guaranteed hours. You're talking about people who don't. So we are at odds with each other.
Yeah.
I'm talking about people who want guaranteed hours and the government is seeking to ensure that they get them. You're talking about people who don't want guaranteed hours as a way of denying people who do their right to have them. That's the problem here, mate.
I mean, I think we're.
No, I just want to clarify that because things. No, I just want to clarify that because I was a bit confused. The legislation is designed to look after people who want guaranteed hours and don't currently get them. You telling me about people who don't want guaranteed hours is not a reason to deny them what they want, is it? We can both agree on that.
I 100% agree.
Yeah, 100% agree. That's what I thought. So what we need is confidence that casual shifts, which most of us have done in our lives, would still exist. And that
that's exactly where I was coming to, because what I believe the bill has the danger of doing is stopping. We've got a dangerous problem in this country with youth unemployment. And if people aren't given the opportunity to gain experience and to gain a few hours a week here and there, we're going to have an even bigger problem with work ethic than we've currently got.
You're moving into slightly different territory. Again, I'm not going to argue with you. The idea that you can come in and do some shifts and learn as a consequence of that while you retain the right to say this hasn't worked out for us, off you trot. It speaks to a slightly different story, but that central point, I'm glad we got there in the end. You need to be able to have casual staff. Every employer benefits from that. But staff who want guaranteed hours should have more protections in law to compel employers to give them guaranteed hours. And thank you for your patience, because it took a while to realise that you were citing people who don't want guaranteed hours on their contracts as a reason to deny that right to people who do. 10:48 is the time, which for me at least doesn't quite wash. That takes us back to about the 90s, I think, for the introduction of the legislation. But I think that casual workers would have been separate or exempt from it even then. It is 10:48.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m.
If you're in a position where another £1,000 to find is the difference between you going on holiday and you not going on holiday, I do actually think for a week, the one family holiday you get to take that year is actually a good reason for you to miss school with your child.
Tom Swarbrick.
With cybersecurity from BT. Security solutions built for businesses.
LBC.
There's some naughty folks out there in cyberspace, and it can be tough to tell a legit deal from a dodgy one. That's why you need Bitdefender, your very own digital heavyweight, working silently behind the scenes to keep you and your devices safe. Whatever threats the web throws at you. Trusted by the experts, used by the pros.
Bitdefender, a global leader in cybersecurity. Trusted, always.
Verify now at bitdefender.com.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.5% AER variable. That includes a 2% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
Oh yeah, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that once-in-a-lifetime adventure. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.41% gross. Terms apply.
Switching to Vodafone full fibre broadband is now as easy as pie. Ooh, freshly baked. It's a walk in the park. Hello, little fella. It's like taking candy from a baby. Come on, as if I'd do that. With One Touch Switch, it's easy. We sort everything out for you. We even contact your current provider. Plus, we'll help towards leaving fees. Switch today to full fibre broadband with Vodafone.
Up to £200 credit to cover leaving fees. More information and terms at vodafone.co.uk/broadband.
For anyone needing assistance when travelling with TfL, such as people with visual or mobility impairments, our Turn Up and Go service has staff on hand to help. It's available at all London Underground, London Overground and Elizabeth Line stations, and there's no need to book. Just turn up and go. That is how we're making the greener way to travel more accessible to all. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Stayshore. What is Stayshore? Stayshore is not just the UK's favourite travel insurance. Stayshore is the confidence that comes with knowing that you're covered by the company with more five-star reviews on Trustpilot than any other provider. A company that welcomes people of all ages with pre-existing medical conditions for single or multiple trips. So Stayshore with Stayshore Travel Insurance. UK's favourite relates to number of five-star Trustpilot reviews, T's and C's and verifications at stayshore.co.uk/reviews.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
It is 10:51. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I don't know if you heard Nick this morning announce that Global and LBC will be the official audio and outdoor partner of Team GB at the Olympic Winter Games, the Milano Cortina in 2026. And I just got to tease you with something. I wonder how many people have been listening to this programme long enough and closely enough to recall what my very close association with the 1996 Team GB Olympics team was. I think it was just the Summer Olympics, actually, not the Winter Olympics. But I mean, this is a hook and tease to end all hook and teases. I can't wait to see something. I was going to say serious suggestions only, but we could all do with a giggle. What was my very surprisingly close association? All right, I'll give you one clue. I wasn't a coach. My surprisingly close association with the 1996 Team GB Olympics team. Okay? I'm almost tempted to offer a prize to anybody who actually knows the answer to that question, because Keith listens quite closely, bless him. Even did before he got this job. You've got no idea, have you? No idea at all. And it's a proper one. I mean, it is a proper one. It brought me into quite close contact with a significant proportion, quite possibly a majority of the athletes. Very close contact with, it didn't involve any cleaning or anything like that. It was quite a serious role. Me, 1996, so I was 24 years old, having quite a serious role, quite an important role with the, I did, anyway, enough, 10:53. I can't remember whether I was on a 0 hours contract at the time. I might have been. Pete's in Bury. Pete, what would you like to say?
Oh, yes. Morning, James.
Hello, Pete.
Just wanted
there's been quite a bit of misinformation about some of the things you've been talking about.
How dare you? Carry on.
Let's take the exclusivity clauses. They have actually been banned under the exclusivity regulation since November 2022. What the bill is trying to do is to extend it because it doesn't cover people below the lower earnings limit.
Right.
And what the bill wants to try and do is to include everybody. So it has been banned since 2022 for, I would say, the majority of 0 hours contract workers.
So this is my point about if you're on a good scratch, then you're kind of compensated for not being available for anybody else, even if you are actually available.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, sure. And coming to the issue about the guaranteed hours, the first thing is a 0 hours worker has the option to request it. An employer doesn't have the right to refuse a request, but if you want, you can still carry on having your hours, which are unpredictable as and when. So you've got the option. Now, this is a classic example of how government philosophy overruns and forgets what the practicalities are.
Go on.
Because let's take, for example, a company who's got a combination of people on guaranteed hours and those who aren't. It's only got so many hours to pass around its staff. So the people who get the first dibs, if there are fewer hours, are the people on the guaranteed hours. The people who are on the fewer hours, because they're not guaranteed any, will get the thin end of the wedge in terms of when they're giving out the hours if there's only a limited number of hours available. Those people are exclusively women,
yes,
with children. So that becomes indirectly discriminatory against women at work. And
so it ends up doing the opposite of what it was designed to do, potentially.
Well, it actually brings in a level of discrimination which it hadn't thought of. Because what they've forgotten is the whole point about 0 hours contracts is that people don't have the number of hours to give everybody full-time work. You know, you're working in a restaurant, or so you need it at different times. And the whole point about 0 hours contracts, okay, there's lots of unfairness about them, but it was to deal with an irregular hours.
Well, like Mark was telling us, you know, a payday is going to be incredibly busy and the rest of the month is not. So it's almost impossible for him to staff consistently across a 4-week period when four of those days out of 28 are going to be incredibly busy and 24 are going to be different.
Yeah, that's right. But I think it's, as I say, whenever legislation's passed, you get the situation where the government thinks it's a good idea, but hasn't really talked to the people who have to make it work. And there's lots of these difficulties. You know, it's going to be a mess because you will get people who are being unfairly treated just because they want to have more flexibility.
So the more flexibility you want, the less reason you will have to welcome this legislation.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow.
I'm glad you were listening. What's your area of expertise? Why do you know so much more about this than I do?
At the moment, I'm an employment consultant for Citizens Advice. So I worked there on a volunteer basis. Before that,
lovely man.
I was an HR consultant, and I've been teaching employee relations and employment law at university.
What would you change? What would you change in the current setup? Anything?
One of the things I would definitely change, and I think this is the thing you did briefly mention earlier, is this question of unfair dismissal, because you're right. You're not quite right, because
I just want to talk to everybody else for a minute and not you. This is how you school me, all right? You do it with charm, you do it with modesty, you do it with a scalpel, not a sledgehammer, all right? Carry on, Pete.
That's what comes of advising employees.
I was going to say, this is you, this is what you do.
Carry on. There is a day one right in the sense that you start to get employment rights, but what they're going to have is what's called a probationary period. At the moment, there's a debate as to whether that should be 6 or 9 months. And during that probationary period, provided the employer follows a fair procedure, they can't claim unfair dismissal because they've been fairly dismissed. But because what happens at the moment, you're absolutely right what you said at the beginning. Literally, after 1 year and 11 months, I don't like you, you've got to go. What the new legislation is bringing in, no matter how long somebody has worked for, you've got to follow a fair procedure.
Yes,
which is only right. One of the difficult.
Well, even if it's a day and a half.
Yes, but you've got to say. Well, I mean, it's going to be a sort of watered down procedure. But you have, instead of saying you're out the door, mate. You can say, it's not working, I'm sorry, you've got to sit down, and you send them a letter and say, you're dismissed.
Oh, okay.
So that's the way to work. But I think the unseen consequence of this, of course, is that it's inevitably going to increase the number of employment tribunal cases. Even at 6 months, is a lot less. The estimate is that'll be 40,000 more a year, costing millions of pounds.
Yeah.
The legal system is already clogged up, and it's taking 18 months now for people to go to an employment tribunal. So when this new legislation comes in, it's going to be even greater.
So I felt that the day one stuff was evidence the Lords were probably getting it right. You think they're largely getting it right on the 0 hours contract stuff as well?
I think so, yeah. I think that what the Lords want to do is to make it 6 months rather than day one.
Yes.
What the government's saying is it's got to be day one, but you've got to have a procedure. And I think the Lords, yeah, I think what you find is obviously the government, the legislation is a political set of regulations to actually pay back for the trade unions. There's actually no question of that. And I'm pro trade unions, don't get me wrong.
No, I hear you. I mean, this is the argument from the other side of the political aisle, is that this is done to, I don't like the word appease, let's shall we say delight trade unions. Who can go back to their members and say, you've won these glorious victories, and in the hope that their members won't turn around and say, could we just dig into the detail a bit, please?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm being objective because I've worked with trade unions all my life. Some of my best friends are trade unions. But I think Angela Rayner unfortunately said, what do you want? They give them everything.
Yeah.
And now that the girls are saying, well, actually, let's look at it in practical terms. She can't back. It's almost like she's backed into a corner because the trade unions are saying, don't change anything. And the Lords are saying, it's actually quite sensible to change anything because it's not workable.
Yeah, and bringing something down from 2 years to 6 months is a win. It's a palpable win, isn't it, by any normal measure, but perhaps not by the... Yeah. Rules of the relationship between Angela Rayner and the... I'm just going to read out a message. Do you mind?
Yeah, go on.
Kelly writes, this guy is talking more sense than you're giving him credit for. Can I just make it clear that I am giving you all the credit?
You absolutely are.
Yes.
Couldn't agree with you more.
All the credit for Pete, which is a perfect conclusion to this hour, actually, which has been around the houses a little bit, largely my fault, but which has been steered straight back onto the straight and narrow by Pete's quite expert contribution. Caller of the day so far, and it will take some beating.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, the destruction caused by Hurricane Melissa will be assessed by officials in Jamaica over the coming hours. The storm was the strongest to hit the island in modern history and has since passed over Cuba. Hundreds of thousands of people are without power and communications. Meteorologist Dr. Ash K. Dioris says the extent of the destruction is not yet clear.
Melissa, when it made a landfall, was a Category 5 with wind speeds over 185 miles an hour, gusting more than 200 miles an hour. So is the strongest cyclone or hurricane that has hit Jamaica, and also the third most intense hurricane we have ever seen in the Atlantic.
More than 100 people are now reported dead after a series of Israeli strikes in Gaza. They were ordered by the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, after he accused Hamas of targeting Israeli troops. President Trump has insisted nothing will jeopardize the ceasefire. More than 40 economists and academics have warned the two-child benefit cap is causing long-term economic damage. A letter to Rachel Reeves from the Leading Figures and seen by LBC says the limit must be overturned in the budget next month. The government says it's drawing up an ambitious strategy to tackle child poverty. Jonathan Portis, a professor of economics at King's College London, says the UK is an international outlier.
No other country that we know of imposes a cap on benefits after two children. It's deeply damaging, not just to the kids and families who are affected, but to the broader social and economic fabric of our country. We would all be better off if child poverty was reduced.
A murder investigation is underway after a man in his 20s was stabbed in southeast London. Police were called to Hither Green just after 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon. It was the third fatal stabbing in London in 24 hours. Women are now able to get the morning after pill free of charge in pharmacies across England. Emergency contraception was already free from most GPs and sexual health clinics, but cost up to £30 from chemists. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 97.42. That's up 45. The pound buys $1.32 and a euro 13. LBC weather, most places seeing some sunshine and showers, strong winds and occasionally heavy rain further north. A high of 14 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Minutes after 11 is the time, and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I'm going to ask you a question I asked you yesterday, but with different context, different facts. I don't know how to play this at the moment. I mean, I know how to play most of it, but I don't know how to play the fact that a lot of the stories completely dominating the news agenda shouldn't be, because they are reflecting very high feelings rather than the stuff that really matters. For example, the conversation we had in the last hour will affect a hell of a lot more people potentially than the facilities or the buildings in which asylum seekers are accommodated while they're waiting for their applications to be processed. But you would not know that from looking at our news agenda. The extraordinary nature of this country at the moment has been completely turned upside down. It was bad enough to start off with, given the dominance of right-wing media, but since Elon Musk bought Twitter, it has gone absolutely bonkers. And the reason is really, really simple. It sells. And if you're not counting, remember, you don't even have to count, you just count clicks now. So even if someone is looking at something with a sense of horror, when you're giving those statistics to an advertiser, that's a customer. So if you are in the attention economy, if you are in the business of drawing as much attention, whether it's positive or negative, to whatever it is you're selling, in this case, simply content on social media, then that is the reality that we currently inhabit. And everything gets exacerbated and magnified out of all sensible proportions. I've only had two, as far as I can tell, but terrible events in Uxbridge yesterday, reportedly involving, and I have to say that for legal reasons, a man who came here from Afghanistan on a lorry. I can't say much more about it for very easy to understand legal reasons, but the kind of people who are, the kind of people I'm thinking of at the moment, the kind of people texting me to insist that there's some sort of conspiracy or some sort of cover up. If somebody gets murdered, the only proper human response to that in the very first instance is horror and sympathy for the people left behind. Then you can, as details emerge, move on to anger at the perpetrator. That's perfectly natural. That's perfectly normal. If somebody gets murdered and your first response is delight at the opportunity it will give you to malign or demonize other people who have absolutely nothing to do with that murder, there is something very deeply wrong with you. But if you're on Twitter, you will feel normal. That is probably the best illustration of the mess that we're in that I'm able to provide you with. So I will say it again. If somebody is murdered, the only decent human reaction in the first instance, if somebody is, God forbid, raped, because there are a couple of stories in the news involving allegedly racially aggravated rape at the moment, which I can't talk about in any more detail for the same reason that I can't talk about events yesterday in Uxbridge. But if somebody is murdered or raped, if your first reaction isn't sympathy for the victim and their families and horror at the act that has been perpetrated, followed by
perfectly naturally, perfectly normally, anger at the perpetrator, there's something very, very wrong with you. If your reaction to a hideous crime, whether it is in Southport, Uxbridge or Wolverhampton, is to rub your hands with glee at the opportunity it provides for you to either spread lies or exaggerations and demonize and attack people who have absolutely nothing to do with those crimes, then there is something very, very wrong with you. And Elon Musk's great achievement since buying Twitter is to make those people feel normal. To respond to hideous crimes by rubbing your hands in glee, rubbing your thighs in delight at the opportunity it provides you with to attack human beings who have nothing whatsoever to do, have no more to do with the crime that's being committed than you do, but you see this as a wonderful opportunity to attack them, you really need to give your head the mother of all wobbles. And it is, I'm afraid, as simple as that. But the reason why he bought Twitter was to create an environment in which that reaction feels normal. To react to a crime by wanting to attack or even perhaps set fire to buildings containing people who have nothing to do with the crime is a hideous human condition that is being fermented and fertilized on social media in ways that are increasingly terrifying. It's not my job to come up with an answer. It's actually the government's now. You've got people calling for violence on our streets against people who've done absolutely nothing wrong. You've got people calling for human beings to be set afire in their beds who've done absolutely nothing wrong, turned into political heroes by the kind of characters, the kind of politicians, the kind of pundits who are rubbing their hands in glee at the opportunity provided by a hideous murder to turn their hatred on people who had no more to do with that murder than they did. I can't believe that I have to say this out loud. It used to be obvious. And the opportunity to take a hideous crime and turn it into a weapon with which to hurt people who had nothing to do with that hideous crime used to be beyond the remit of public discourse. It used to be beyond quite literally the pale. But it's normal now. And as soon as it becomes normal on Twitter, and this is why Elon Musk bought it, it starts becoming normal outside Twitter. It starts becoming normal in the pages of your newspapers. On a much less serious level, when somebody like Sarah Pochin expresses hideously racist views on a television station that exists essentially to disseminate hideous views, it used to be beyond the pale. When they invited Nick Griffin onto Question Time, it was a subject of national debate. A subject of national debate, the leader of the British National Party. People were queuing up on both sides to say, everybody agrees that his views are hideous, but they should be heard so that we can deal with them. Now, Sarah Pochin comes out with views that Nick Griffin would consider absolutely correct, and the argument up to and including Daily Mail columnist like Richard Littlejohn, where the world has moved so much, the argument is, well, she's not said anything wrong. It's ridiculous even to suggest that the racism she did is racist. It all is about normalization and moving windows. So on a rhetorical level, you've got Sarah Pochin and Robert Jenrick doing the racism, secure in the knowledge that some useful idiots, fellow travellers, and indeed fellow racists will join them in pretending that it's not racism. And then when a hideous crime happens, these people don't see tragedy, they don't see horror, they see opportunity. They see the opportunity to attack people who had nothing to do with the crime. And I think it is a British value to remind you that we are better than that. Purely, simply, and correctly. We are better than that. And what we discussed yesterday was the difficulty of identifying people who are not in that category, but who are, for example, exercised by the accommodation of asylum seekers in buildings in their community that used to be hotels, that still have the word hotel, perhaps, on the sign outside, but are nothing like what they were like when people were paying 100 quid a night, 200, 300 quid a night to stay there. I came away from yesterday's programme surprisingly encouraged, largely by a caller called Tamara, who rang from Telford, who is, I fear, about to become part of the programme's furniture in a positive way, akin to the way in which that woman in the jewellery room at Isleworth Crown Court in February became part of the furniture of the programme for a while in a very negative way. She's the one that was telling fellow jurors that Brigitte Macron or Michelle Obama are definitely men, and that Volodymyr Zelensky has spent all the aid money sent to Ukraine on three of the biggest yachts in the world. And she had the photos to prove it, because she'd found them on social, she'd seen them on social media. And it was both the matter of factness, and because I'm prejudiced in some ways, her middle classness, that really resonated with me. She seemed educated. It's probably the best way of putting it. And sadly, we live in a country where education and class often, but not always, go hand in hand. And I don't know how many people, because the public discourse has been so hideously skewed by the leeching of racist hatred from Twitter now into a mainstream media in this country that was already pretty racism adjacent, but has now got all in on defending the racism of people like Sarah Pochin and Robert Jenrick, including many members of the Tory party and obviously the Farage party. I just don't know. I still don't know how many people are in each camp. The unreachables, who see a hideous tragedy and think here's a wonderful opportunity to attack people who had nothing to do with it, but who are the same colour as someone who reportedly did, or the same ethnicity, or have something similar on their background or on their CV. Let's attack all of them. Let's set fire to a building full of people that had nothing to do with the crime that's just been committed because they, them, other, this. I don't know. How do you count them? And then you've got the people who Keir Starmer is trying to, what word are you going to use here? Appease? Reach? Woo? Persuade? And the story has changed since yesterday. In a way that's a little bit embarrassing for me, because I presumed that the big drive behind the desire or the plan to move more asylum seekers into army barracks, into disused military barracks, and they are largely disused, and if they are used, they're not used for permanent accommodation. So that was the first lie that the right-wing media set running yesterday. The possibility is, the very real possibility is that it will actually cost more to accommodate them in disused army barracks than it does in hotels. This story, of course, lands on the same day that we discover the profits posted by the companies given the contracts to run the so-called hotels that are not hotels, they're kind of glorified dormitories, have hit record levels once again. That, for me, as a clear-eyed and honest man, that for me is the scandal here, that the three major suppliers behind this system have already made £383 million in profits through these contracts. But the government, it emerged yesterday, may end up paying more in some cases for the accommodation than they are paying to put these people in hotels. And the reason that they've given, and this is a very different conversation from the one we had yesterday, a very different justification, rationale, explanation than the one we had yesterday. It's worth paying extra money to quell public disquiet. I want you to think about this for a moment. It's worth paying extra money to quell public disquiet. So what you have now, and hold my hand here, because I'm going into this cold this morning. What you have now is two constituencies. The one we explored yesterday were the people with, quotes, legitimate concerns, end quotes. And that's not a snide quote, by the way. That's why I enjoyed Tamara's call so much, because she really nailed legitimate concerns about immigration without sounding remotely racist. And I also worry about the cost of this because, well, in very simple terms, a few companies are making £383 million out of the deal. So I guess I suffer from a form of public disquiet about these costs, caused largely by the size of the backlog, of course, which was, of course, a consequence of the last government. But only, I don't know whether anybody cares about that anymore. We might find out at PMQs. And now you've got the government saying, no, 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 no. It's not them. It's not that public disquiet that we're worried about. We're not worried about the people who think that the cost is unsustainable and unjustifiable.
we're worried about the people who don't want these facilities in their towns. We're worried about the public disquiet of people not wanting these facilities in their environs. So we're going to move them to somebody else's environs. We're going to move them into more isolated parts of the country. I haven't checked, but there'll be protests outside the army barracks soon, if there aren't already. Because that first category of people don't want them anywhere. And that is a real and unignorable phenomenon. We don't want them anywhere. The second category of people don't think we should be spending as much money on this as we currently are. And the third category of people probably think that the best way of working through this backlog is the way that we are currently working through it. I know I'm not in the first category. I don't think, or certainly yesterday I wasn't in the third category. I was in the second category because I thought that it was costing too much to do it and that this would be cheaper. But the government have come out today, or yesterday, and defended the prospect of paying more to house asylum seekers in disused military barracks instead of hotels, because the cost is worth it. It's a price worth paying to quell public disquiet. My question to you is twofold. Is it? And will it? 0345 6060 973 is the number you need. Is this good politics? So you remember the protests outside the hotel in Epping because of a, at the time, allegations, now convicted criminal, a sex offender who'd assaulted a 14-year-old girl and a woman, and people used his activities, his crimes, to malign everybody else in the building. And that's a lot easier to understand than reading about a crime on the other side of the country and deciding that that is somehow relevant to the people of the same ethnicity living around the corner from you. So you got the protests, you got the people saying it's just concerned mums. The man that they were concerned about had already been collared at that point, but they were concerned mums. And it was hard to feel the same negativity towards them that you feel to the kind of people using more recent crimes to make political capital. But will it quell public disquiet? And is it worth spending the money? I'm really confused this morning, because I don't think it will work, and it completely ignores those of us who thought that the motivation was to save some of the money that's currently making its way into the pockets of the private sector. The government thinks it's worth paying more money to move people from accommodation near you to accommodation not quite as near somebody else, and accommodation that I think we probably all agree will be even more Spartan than the accommodation that they're in now. So they're moving them to more Spartan accommodation that costs more. Let me be clear. The reason why I find all of this so interesting is because because I don't know how many people there are in each camp. But B, because I want it to work. I want to believe that this problem that the country is dealing with at the moment can be addressed in a sane and rational sense. I'm just not sure this is the sane and rational way to do it. Is this good politics? 0345 6060 973. Moving asylum seekers from former hotels in built-up residential areas to more isolated and more Spartan army barracks, even if it costs more money. So in a way, you've got someone looking at a two-page spread in a newspaper, and on the left-hand side today, you've got the cost of the current scheme, and on the right-hand side, you've got the mothers outside the hotels with the placards, and they're going to increase that story, so the number in that headline is going to go up, it's going to cost more, but the mothers outside the former hotels with the placards are not going to be as worried anymore as they were yesterday. Is it going to work? 0345 6060 973. And is it good policy from Keir Starmer? I'm not sure, but I don't think so. I really need to hear from you on this. If you hit the numbers now, you will get through. 0345 6060 973 is the number you need.
This is LBC.
ITV presents...
Oh, my God.
Gas!
There is a chemical weapon in the cab.
We are dealing with a serial killer.
The devices are designed to kill, but first he wants to suffocate them. I'm spent.
I can't watch you give everything until you've got nothing left.
I take risks. That's my job.
Help! Lana!
Hold your breath. Trigger Point. Available now on ITVX.
In a world speeding to make car finance claims, make sure you're in full control. You don't need to go with a claims company and risk losing more than 30% of what you're owed. Put yourself in pole position. Don't rush. Be ready.
Looking to make a claim on your car finance? Get 100% of the facts. Go to fca.org.uk/car-finance-claims.
Claiming soon.
Imagine the varifocal lens of the future, personalised to you, engineered with artificial intelligence and powered by your visual behaviour. Experience instantly sharp vision in motion with Varilux XR Pro lenses from Essilor. Find your local optician at essilor.com and ask for Varilux XR Pro.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
24 minutes after 11. Sorry, the reason I go on a bit, I know I always go on a bit, but the reason I go on even perhaps more than usual on this kind of subject is that I'm torn between ignoring the heat that is carefully cultivated by all the usual suspects surrounding the issue of asylum seekers' accommodation, and the light, which is my perhaps naive belief that you can help people caught up in that fury and that fire. You can help some, if not all, but most of the people out of it with reasonable discussion, facts and compassion. And I can't ever let go of that. But it ties me in knots sometimes, and today is one of those days. Yesterday, I thought they were moving asylum seekers to army barracks to save money. Today, I learn that even if it costs more money, it's worth doing to, quotes, quell public disquiet. Will it work? Is it good policy? And actually, one of those days where I'm also asking you, what do you think? 25 minutes after 11 is the time. Some pretty good texts on this, which I'll share with you shortly. There's a couple of phone lines free if you want to get involved, including an awful lot of people critiquing my, or rather expressing impatience at my failure so far to reveal exactly what my involvement with the 1996 Team GB Olympics team was. This on the day that we announce LBC and Global's audio partnership with the Olympic team for the looming Winter Olympics. We are the official audio and outdoor partner of Team GP, but it reminded me of my own quite deep involvement in the Olympic movement of 1996. I promise I will share that with you shortly. But this is the question. Is this going to work? Is it a price worth paying? And crucially, is it good policy? Who is it? Are there people? Are there enough pleasable people out there to make the policy plausible? Steve's in Octorada. Steve, what would you like to say?
Well, good morning. It's like they're proposing to move them to barracks in Inverness, the Cameron Barracks.
Yes.
Cameron Barracks are as near as Dammit in the centre of Inverness City.
Yeah, so but they're not. They feel different from hotels, don't they?
Yeah. Oh, it will do. It will do. But I cannot see how that would alter the situation with the.
Public disquiet, that if it is, you know, in a similar sort of area to where the hotels were, how is it going to change the so-called public disquiet?
Exactly. I can't see it working.
Well, let's stop and think. Part of the public disquiet is probably born of, I don't know quite what the word is, it's not envy, but when I say hotel, what do you see?
Me? I know what I mean. I know what you mean, and I know what the government mean by hotel.
No, I mean, do you know what I see? You say four-star hotel in England. I see the Imperial Hotel in Exmouth in Devon in about 1981, yeah. Which I thought was Eden. I thought it was the Garden of Eden, Steve. I thought it was paradise on earth. And I think that's what happens to a lot of people. I remember when Farage turned up with his Fisher-Price video camera at one of them and took lots of footage of the sign outside.
designed entirely to create the idea that the people inside were enjoying all the luxuries that that hotel offered when the sign was put up. You know they weren't, I know they weren't, but there's public disquiet at the idea that they are living a life of unearned luxury, and therefore if you move them to a barracks, that public disquiet is quelled. That will work, even if the barracks is in the middle of town.
It possibly might do. It possibly might do. I just have forebodings, that's all.
Because it is quelling disquiet that's built on nonsense.
Yeah, well, my opinion of all prejudice is that it is built basically on ignorance and fear. And I think people like Farage are playing on people's ignorance and fear.
Well, obviously
and
they are.
The
and you can't pop those balloons of bile with policy, process and, quote, sensible, end quotes, attempts to quell public disquiet. I don't know. I don't know. And who's going to admit, oh, I don't mind them staying in a barracks. I was just really cross when I believed lies about where they were staying before. And that, I hope, is not the sentence that's going to come to define this entire hour. Thank you, Steve. Speaking of defining this entire hour, Dave's been in touch. Are you not going to speak about yesterday's news, James, regarding immigrants loose in the streets? I'm going to add a reportedly or an allegedly here, Dave, because that's how the law works, killing innocent people. Mate, I did 14 minutes on it, literally a quarter of an hour ago. You can rewind live radio, you can listen to it, and you should, Dave, because I'm talking directly and explicitly about you and anybody else minded to send a message like that to a radio program like this. The law limits some of what we can say, but you, Dave, are one of those people who witnesses or hears about a terrible crime and feels joy and glee at the opportunity to attack other people. Usually, of course, people who share characteristics or attributes with the alleged perpetrator, but in your tragic little case, mate, you see it as an opportunity to attack me. There's a family mourning today, a family going through the most unimaginable horrors. And Dave thinks, I know, I'm going to have a pop at that bloke on the radio because, I don't really know why, but he's always making me feel a little bit dirty about how racist I am. Morning, Dave. Here's Thomas Watts with your headlines.
The destruction caused by Hurricane Melissa will be assessed by officials in Jamaica over the coming hours. The storm was the strongest to hit the island in modern history and has since passed over Cuba. More than 100 people are now reported dead after a series of Israeli airstrikes in Gaza. Benjamin Netanyahu ordered the attacks after accusing Hamas of killing an IDF soldier. A government minister has recommitted to a target to build 1.5 million homes in England by the next election. That's despite a warning from house builders they won't be able to meet the pledge. LBC weather, sunshine and showers for many places, the strong winds and occasionally heavy rain pushing further north, a high of 14 degrees.
This is LBC. Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m.
I have found completely shocking the extent of the anti-Semitism that people have felt because of what's been going on in the Middle East, emboldened not just to criticise the Israeli government, but to use what is happening in the Middle East as a way of allowing you to expose what you really believe. And I think a lot of people have shown themselves for what they really are.
Tom Swarbrick with cybersecurity from BT. Security solutions built for businesses. LBC.
Stayshore. What is Stayshore? Stayshore is not just the UK's favourite travel insurance. Stayshore is the confidence that comes with knowing that you're covered by the company with more five-star reviews on Trustpilot than any other provider. A company that welcomes people of all ages with pre-existing medical conditions for single or multiple trips. So Stayshore with Stayshore Travel Insurance. UK's favourite relates to number of five-star Trustpilot reviews, T's and C's and verifications at stayshore.co.uk/reviews.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Tax is changing. From April 2026.
If you're a sole trader or a landlord,
with a turnover above £50,000,
you'll need to use recognised software to keep records
and send quarterly updates of your income and expenses.
There's no avoiding it. Tax is changing. Get ready. Search HMRC Making Tax Digital.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
11:33. It is Wednesday. I hope that doesn't come as a major surprise to anybody, but that means it will be PMQs at 12 PM today. Natasha Clark joining me just before to cast an eye over what is likely to come up. I sometimes say it'd be a bit tricky to predict it this week, and then Natasha comes in and predicts it, and I go, oh, no, it wasn't tricky at all. Because she pays more attention than I do. But I don't know. Most immediately obvious, a couple of things that Keir Starmer would raise if he was a slightly different politician. The attempts to turn the China spy case into political capital could not have gone worse for Kemi Badenoch, of course. And it has emerged today that despite her attempts last week or the week before to claim that she had, as business secretary or whatever the job was that she had, distanced herself enormously from China, she actually sent a trade delegation there with instructions to get as much business as possible. So I don't know what's going to come up there. You can find out. I do know that the situation in the United States continues to justify our decision to have Simon Marks on permanent standby. I'm interested in the New York mayoral race, among other things, at the moment, and the most extraordinary journalistic debacle presided over by Tony Gallagher, the editor of The Times, involving the mayoral candidate Mamdani in New York, suggests to me that Rupert Murdoch and others are very, very worried about the prospect of this guy being elected mayor of New York. For the hatchet job to have crossed the Atlantic over what is essentially a local government issue in a foreign country is not unique, not unprecedented, but it's certainly rare. But the desperation to land punches on this guy has led the Times into one of the most embarrassing journalistic faux pas that I can remember. I mean, truly breathtaking. 11:35 is the time. Back to the question of whether moving asylum seekers from so-called hotels, repurposed hotels. I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? Is they've given up on that bit of the argument. We need to explain to people that the accommodation that these human beings are staying in is far from salubrious. It is far from luxurious. It has absolutely nothing to do with the number of stars on the sign outside the building that is being repurposed to accommodate asylum seekers. So they've waved the white flag on that, but think they can quell public disquiet by moving them to barracks. I just don't see it. Neil's on the Black Isle. Is that the Neil?
It is, James. If there is, I'm assuming there's more than one Neil, but I'm right. One of the Neils.
How many are there on the Black Isle, though? That's what we need to know. I don't know.
Not too many, I don't think. It's. I mean, even though it is probably a Scottish heritage name, obviously I don't have a Scottish.
It's true. Well, the reason I know, for people who are confused, is because you are a copper turned most excellent crime novelist, and I want to know what you. You're also not too far away from where one of these barracks is going to be.
Indeed, yeah. I mean. Obviously, like everybody else, I mean, I'm forced onto social media sometimes, and it
you got books
depress
to sell.
Me. I have got books to sell, and I mean, certainly X is of absolutely no value to help you selling books. No. In these days, I mean, the way the algorithm has been skewed, that's a completely a departed duck, as you might say. Mm. But yes, no, I mean, I've been following this, and the simple fact is, if the government think this is going to quell the masses that are stirring themselves into a fury on X, they're sadly mistaken.
Point, sorry to jump in, is that we know that, but how many people are there with concerns or feeling disquiet that is quellable? We know the appallingly overrepresented unquellable disquiet, which is, you know, borderline race wars now, I think Elon Musk is essentially calling for on the streets of Britain. You're never going to reach people like that with dull, hopefully sensible process. But do you reckon there are many people who are reachable, whose disquiet is quellable?
I think it's really hard. I mean, I was watching a local Facebook group that's all based in Inverness, and it's kind of exploded with a mix of people saying, well, what do we do with them? How do we deal with these people in this situation? Through to literally proto-fascism around, you know, really, I couldn't even repeat it on air. You'd have to switch me off.
To give you a mild, I mean, there'll be plenty of people, and you don't need to be Sherlock Holmes to know this, who, when the tabloid media have told them that everybody homeless begging on the streets is actually living in a house around the corner and leading a life of Riley and swinging the lead, they absolutely hate all homeless people, whereas today they'll be wondering why we can't put our homeless people in these barracks instead of these asylum seekers.
Well, yeah, there is, I mean, there's completely that. But we had Cameron Barracks, which is in Inverness, which has been used to house some Afghan migrants. But these are people, I think, who were assisting the British government over there. Nobody seemed to have a problem with that. Generally, I think probably because they weren't aware.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, it's mainstream news.
And they've released the names of the barracks. You're going to have protests outside if you don't already.
Absolutely. Cameron Barracks is actually quite central in Inverness. It's very close to a school. It's very close to some shopping areas. So people are jumping up and down. We don't want them here. Now, if they think this is a cheap option, we know it's not a cheap option. They've already said it's going to cost £1 million just to sort out the asbestos at Cameron 1.6. Barracks. Yeah, and there's obviously all the money involved in just refitting it. Now, I think what the type of person who might celebrate people being put in old army camps thinks is they think they're going to be secure. Well, they're not. These are places with just like low fences. You can't keep people in.
They're not supposed to be incarcerated. Confined to barracks as a figure of speech. So that adds to public disquiet. The only thing I've got, Neil, is this game I played with John in Octorada about what you see when I say hotel. And I don't even know whether the Imperial Hotel in Exmouth is still there, but we didn't stay in hotels when I was a kid. It was a good, we stayed at, when I was very, very tiny, but I'm too young to remember, we stayed at a hotel in Morecambe, where Mum recalls that my nappies somehow managed to block the drains. But the best holiday we had, once they started paying school fees, was in a caravan in Brittany, except for one summer, and I can't remember what happened, but we went to stay at the Imperial Hotel in Exmouth, and I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. It was the most magnificent, luxurious place I'd ever visited in my life. You say hotel, I see that, even though it's a 42-year-old memory. And that is the disquiet. It's the people who think they're living really nice lives, perhaps even nicer than their own lives, who are now going to hear barracks instead of hotel. That's the only disquiet I can imagine being quelled.
It won't work because the people are not happy. They won't be happy. They just want them nowhere near them. And it's a difficult problem for the government. I actually sympathise with the government on this one. Because, they cannot solve the problem in Sudan, the problem in Eritrea, the problems in Syria, the problems in Afghanistan, which is what is the driver for people coming, well, not just to this country. We're one of the smaller uptakers of asylum seekers.
Something else that they seem to have waved the white flag on when it comes to fighting feelings with facts. This is a policy designed to address feelings that are built on non-facts.
And if it lasts until the end of the week, it won't last anyway. It won't last at all. They're already talking about protests in Inverness, about blockading. Nothing is going to work. Nothing they do will work. You have them in a city, that won't work. They won't like that. Put them out where traditionally your old army bases and RAF bases are. They won't like that because these are close to other smaller communities. What do we then do? How are these, you can't lock people in. People seem to think these are going to be secure barracks. They won't be, If they think this is going to quell the masses, they're wrong.
I'm going to keep worrying at the question of where the masses end and the reachable people or the quellable disquiet begins, because I have to, and also because I find it really interesting. I think it's a really good question. When's the next book out?
Well, the next one's out in paperback next month.
Is that The Devil You Know?
No, When Shadows Fall, one all based in the Scottish Highlands. Lovely. And then I've got another one coming out in March next year.
Now, look at that. Amazing. There's a work ethic for you. Neil, stay safe, mate. It is 11:42. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC.
This is it, isn't it? We're trying to quell people who are deliberately, performatively and quite violently unquellable. And here's little old James on the radio wondering about how many nice people there are who have genuine concerns built upon things that aren't true about repurposed hotels in their community, whose concerns will be assuaged by the relocation of the people in the repurposed hotels to army barracks. Jay says, it's just about perception, isn't it? Migrants stored at army barracks, I assume, has a locked-up feeling to the average Joe versus a hotel. A point that Neil touched upon. It looks to me like they're still trying to avoid the opprobrium of the right-wing media instead of standing up for what is right. I think that's moved on to a whole new level, with the owner of Twitter essentially calling for racist violence on our streets. There is another category, says Angie. People being housed in not hotels need to be protected from the yobs who are protesting. They won't like the barracks either, but hopefully it won't be for as long as under previous governments. Bruce, it's not about the accommodation, it's about hatred of all asylum seekers. Wherever you put them won't make any difference. The hotels are just far too toxic now. This is about as close to optimism as we get with Ronan. As horrible as this may be, it seems like the only next logical step the government can take, at least to stop the leader of the frog people making political capital out of all this misery. Of course it's not going to work, writes Tom. The government is crossing the threshold of basing all policy on the public's feelings when they should be dealing solely in facts. I voted Labour, but I'm sick of the lack of spine. And there's a lot more where that came from. Sarah is in Halstead. Sarah, what would you like to say?
It fits in with an awful lot that people have already said, actually. Okay. I think the thing that the government really needs to do is completely change the discussion. At the moment, it's still bowing down to reforms agenda and not actually pushing the actual reality of the situation. The fact is, as you have said, that the hotels are not hotels, they're
repurposed.
Really hostels.
Yes, yes.
And they're dumps. I am part of a group who teaches English to asylum seekers in Wethersfield barracks, ex-barracks. And before the base opened, there was a huge amount of hostility to it opening and being full of asylum seekers.
Right.
And it was pushed largely by the far right, who kept on telling people that you'd have a load of young men who would be
fighting age, Sarah. Fighting age, don't forget.
Sexually rampaging.
Yes.
Yes.
And then they find one out of 1,000 who may fit that category, and it's proof that the other 999 are guilty as well.
Yeah.
Wonder why we don't do that with reform MPs. You find one reform MP who's been locked up for battering a British woman. Why don't we tar them all with the same brush? Why don't we claim that they're all somehow just massive assaults on women waiting to happen? A bit weird, that, but anyway, on we go.
And in fact, in the Epping demonstrations, quite a few really bad sexual offenders were noticed in the crowd outside campaigning against the hotel.
40% of the men arrested had come to the authorities' attention previously regarding allegations of domestic abuse. You're absolutely right, but who cares about that stuff when there's a race war to foment? What do you learn by doing the teaching of the English at the barracks about these people? The majority of these people.
The majority that we see are nice men who have been in very difficult situations. Most of are coming from Sudan at the moment, which we know is now becoming more obvious that it's a massive war going on there and a huge amount of famine as well and terrible attacks and violence on people. And they've gone through, we don't ask them about their past, but they've gone through terrible journeys to get here. They believe that Britain is a safe and kind country, and I feel really sorry that I can't say that everyone here is. Yeah. But I do think that the majority of people in Britain, actually, if they knew the facts, an awful lot of them would not be so anti-refugee.
You have to cling to that.
I think it's being stirred up.
Well, we know that, and I just don't know that the people that we're both thinking about and putting a lot of faith in are actually going to be reached by a relocation from repurposed hotels into barracks.
No, they're not. No. The only way to get over this in some ways is actually to meet refugees and asylum seekers.
You know, there's a group in Manchester who've started putting out their own version. They've started pushing back. A Greater Manchester Asylum Hotels Group, our response to the protests outside hotels. Here's one. We understand that people have concerns about the cost of asylum hotels to taxpayers. We live on £9.95 per week.
Yeah.
That's only plus food, but £9.95 a week and a very unappetizing diet on that as well.
And although the barracks outside Weatherfield is not quite as bad as it was when it first opened, it isn't run well. It makes a huge amount of money for Clear Springs, who've been really given great contracts.
Yep.
They don't put the money back into the people living there. There's almost nothing to do there. Nowadays there is some sport, which is great, because the vast majority of people there are absolutely football mad.
It's a Daily Mail front page waiting to happen. They play football!
And they live mainly in five people to a room.
Mm.
So it makes sleeping extremely difficult. So we have about 50 or 60 people come to our classes. They're all very, very keen, active learners. They're fantastic what they'll... You know, I'm hopeless at languages, but these people, they really work during that lesson. They really want to learn English.
Because they want to get to work. Because
kind.
They want to get out and get to work as soon as possible.
And rebuild a life that has been shattered in most cases.
Thank you.
And about 85% of them will get agreement to stay. So I do think what does help is speeding up decisions.
It was deliberately halted by the previous government.
Yeah.
Presumably to create a situation like this for political reasons, whether it would add weight to the Rwanda nonsense or whether it would leave the next government, in this case the Labour government, with one almighty mess to solve that people like Chris Philp could pretend wasn't their fault.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
I would say the main reason I go and do is teaching is because it's immensely enjoyable and very nice to meet people who are so nice and so keen to learn. So I'm not doing something good. I'm doing something which is just...
You're also doing something good, but I appreciate you don't want to be the one to say that. So I will. This is a really interesting thing. Zoe Gardner has brought it to the world's attention on social media earlier in the week. I'm afraid I missed it, but asylum seekers housed in hotels in Manchester are reaching out in their own words to address the concerns of the local community. I've just shared it on Blue Sky. That is arguably what the government should be doing, and what Sarah just did, fighting feelings built on lies and very carefully cultivated hatred with facts. Facts include, of course, the knowledge that every single demographic in this country will produce criminals. Whether you want to look at star signs, whether you want to look at social class, whether you want to look at immigration status, whether you want to look at country of birth, whether you want to look at, think of something else that is variable and different. There will be wrong-uns in every single one of those categories. And for a long time, it looked as if radio presenters were horribly disproportionately overrepresented in the annals of paedophiles. And nobody claimed that all radio presenters should be punished or burnt in their beds because it turned out that one of them was a paedophile or one of them was a criminal. If you're going to do this, you need to own your racism. You need to say, oh, no, I don't do it for any other category. I certainly wouldn't suggest that because one man elected to Parliament as an MP for Reform had been locked up, apparently with Nigel Farage's full knowledge, he ran as an MP despite having been locked up for beating up a former girlfriend, a British woman, if that matters to you. Who on earth would claim that that means they're all dodgy? Who on earth would claim? I mean, not just, of course, the ludicrous association of culpability with people who had nothing to do with the crime, but by dint of saying that we knew about this when we invited him into Parliament, we invited him to sit on our benches, we knew that he had been locked up for beating up a former girlfriend, kicking in the head of a former girlfriend. Why would you not extrapolate from his case the conclusion that all Reform MPs should be treated like wife beaters? Why would you not do that? Oh, yeah, because you're racist.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
House builders have warned the government's budget watchdog ministers will not hit their target to build 1.5 million homes by the end of the decade. It's a further blow to Rachel Reeves. Let's turn to Steve Turner, Executive Director of the Home Builders Federation.
The projections they have made over the period of the next 5 years are, we feel, somewhat ambitious, and that whilst we absolutely welcome the changes this government has made with regards to planning and the ambition that the government got to get to 1.5, there are some significant barriers that still remain that the government has to tackle.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast.
With cybersecurity from BT. Security solutions built for businesses.
Back tomorrow morning from 7, LBC.
You have 30 seconds to defuse a bomb. But it isn't any bomb. It's a chemical weapon filled with poisonous gas planted by a serial killer. You need quiet. But your ears never stop ringing. You haven't slept properly in months.
Oh, God.
You're on the edge. And you've only got 3 seconds left.
Dad! Lana!
Trigger Point. Available now on ITVX. Hold your breath.
You plan a holiday. You plan a commute. Meal plans. Career plans. Even workouts need a plan. So doesn't it stand to reason that your money has one too? Because the sad truth is, if it doesn't, it's just sitting there, barely growing, if at all. That's why you need a money plan. And Quilter can help. It's a lot easier to stick to than a workout plan. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future, with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line, already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth Line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Switching to Vodafone full fibre broadband is now as easy as pie. Ooh, freshly baked. It's a walk in the park. Hello, little fella. It's like taking candy from a baby. Come on, as if I'd do that. With One Touch Switch, it's easy. We sort everything out for you. We even contact your current provider. Plus, we'll help towards leaving fees. Switch today to full fibre broadband with Vodafone.
Up to £200 credit to cover leaving fees. More information and terms at vodafone.co.uk/broadband.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. Holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 6060973.
It is 11:55. The man responsible for that, the criminal, the pervert responsible for the protests outside the hotel in Epping, has been successfully deported. But there's even a twist in that tale that Natasha Clark will share with us shortly. Before that, on an altogether lighter note, I suppose I should really reveal the enormous scoop that I've been teasing you with all morning. This, to mark the announcement earlier today that LBC and Global are the official audio and outdoor partner of Team GB. I wondered if you knew what my involvement was, my quite heavy involvement was with the 1996, Team GB Olympic team. Do you know, Natasha? Were you born? I was born in 1996. I don't remember the GB Olympics. It was. We did quite well. We only got one gold. Well, two technically. Were you involved in that? I wasn't in the boat with Matthew Pinson and Steve Redgrave, but I did have direct contact with both of them in the run. I helped them prepare. Did you interview them? No. Oh no, it's much more exciting than that. And not only them, I helped Ben Ainslie, Steve Backley, Roger Black, Jonathan Edwards. Helped. I helped them prepare. If it wasn't for me, they wouldn't have been able to get on the plane. You chased them on... My help, they wouldn't have been able to get on the plane to the 1996 Olympics, which were Atlanta. They weren't able to get on the plane without your help. I don't think they would have been allowed on the plane without my help. Without what I had done for them being done.
Did you check the passports?
No, nothing like that.
Stamp them?
No.
Stamp them in?
I was the official outfitter.
Oh, my gosh, I love that.
So I measured the inside legs of, not all, because I work with my colleagues on this, but of the entire male Team GP, myself and my colleagues at Aquascutum on Regent Street, kitted them all out in the official blazers, club check trousers. They had some lovely kit and caboodle. And I have to tell you, do you know what off the peg means? So it's
ready,
like
ready to go.
Yeah, so like a the sizes suit. Precisely. Yeah. So usually it's a 6-inch drop. If you've got a 40-inch chest, you'll have 34-inch waist trousers. The trousers come with the jacket. It's all very straight. These men.
But you had them totally tailored.
They were monsters.
Perfect.
I mean, some of the thighs, Matthew Pinsent's thighs, we had to build trousers especially to accommodate. It was the most extraordinary tailoring experience of my life. Yes, but all of them, every single, and some of them had not really ever found smart clothes that fitted them before because they were bloody weightlifters. Can you imagine trying to find a suit that fits a weightlifter? It was an extraordinary challenge to which we rose, and I think it's fair to say, had it not been for our ministrations, then Chris Ball Boardman, who won his bronze that year, I think, one of the beginning of him becoming a household name, would not have been allowed onto the plane without the proper kit and caboodle.
Did they wear these suits to get on the plane with? So were they pictured going up the plane
all of that,
in your
yeah.
suits?
Yeah, it was incredibly proud. Well, there weren't suits, nice to be clear. It was a blazer and slacks ensemble.
Okay, right. So it wasn't like, you know, the kit that they
necks
went on.
As well. Some of them had necks. Our shirts only went up to about 18 inches. For some of these lads,
to get them pulled in.
Honestly, they had necks like tree trunks. It was extraordinary. Anyway, I said there was a twist in the tale of Hadush Kibatu, probably the best-known sex offender, I was about to say, in the country, no longer in the country, but even as the government announced a, quote, successful deportation, end quote, evidence emerges to give some grist to the mill of the people who would deny them even that dubious pleasure.
Yeah, that's right, James. So we had the news quite early this morning, around 5:30 this morning, the Home Office confirmed that sex offender who was mistakenly released from prison last week had now left. He's now in Ethiopia. It was confirmed earlier today. In the last few minutes, the Home Office have also just confirmed that he was, in fact, given £500 of taxpayers' cash in order to get on this plane. You'll remember Hadush Kibatu. He sexually assaulted a 14-year-old girl and a woman just days after arriving in Britain. The Home Office tell us today that he was escorted by five bodyguards. They tell us that the reason for this was doing, they say it's a discretionary £500 payment. It sounds like, reading between the lines, it was basically because they thought he might kick off or launch a legal challenge if they...
Knowing he would have to leave, but postponing the moment of truth. Members of the removals team essentially said, if we give you 500 quid, will you get on this plane?
Yeah.
And he said yes.
And it's not an uncommon thing. We do it a lot. We pay, it's a part of a facilitated return scheme. We pay a lot of people a lot of money to leave the country. I think last year it was something like £70 million in total. It's a lot of money. Obviously,
politically, it's a lot less than people would
and
pay.
Exactly. And obviously, Shabana Mahmood today, David Lammy today, very clear that it's worth putting him on a plane. It's worth putting five officers there to help forcibly deport him, and it's obviously in the eyes of Home Office officials who have authorised this payment, worth giving him that money to get him out of the country. And as such was the uproar over him, obviously the protest that sparked, and of course last week with that disastrous decision from HMP Chelmford to accidentally, they believe, due to a Home Office error, release him. And I'm sure this will come up at Prime Minister's questions in the next few minutes, James.
Albeit that the scheme was in place under previous governments as well, and the Home Office staff who would have made this decision, the removals team who would have made this decision, would have had no contact whatsoever with ministers, something that
That's
I think Alex Norris
true.
Has made absolutely clear today. So it's not a political problem, but that won't stop Kemi Badenoch from trying to make hay with it. What else do you think will come up?
Yeah, I think it's been a bad week for the Home Office, hasn't it? We've had that disastrous report on Monday about the which came from the Home Affairs Select Committee, talking about the state of the Home Office, saying it's not fit for purpose, and even Shabana Mahmood, the new Home Secretary, has admitted as such. The Kibatu affair, you've had obviously asylum accommodation, the government's plans to try and put more people into barracks. However, as you were talking about earlier, maybe admitting that it's not even going to save the government any money in order to do so, but the government believe that it is worth doing that in order to take the heat off the front pages and to take that political pressure away from them. But it does feel like it has been, we talked about the grooming gangs
Absolute
inquiry
shocker.
Last. Yeah, we talked about the grooming gangs inquiry last week, didn't we? And obviously the way that, that inquiry is still struggling to get off the ground, it does feel like it's been a really, really tough week for the Home Office. And I'm sure that Kemi Badenoch will be wanting to put the boot in on what she thinks, I'm sure, will be a bit of a weak Achilles heel there.
We're poised to cross live, but do you want to see something really funny?
Always.
I'm just showing my phone to...
Can I read it out?
Yeah, go on.
At Mr. James O.B. Scubby Social, this is your Blue Sky account. Still, this is a message that you've just shown me. Still got my 96 blazer, James. Has a lovely ice cream seller's quality to the stripe ice cream emoji. Suits you, sir. That is from Matt Pinsent?
Yes,
Pinsent.
The gold medal one of the finest rowers, one of the most successful Olympians in the history of this country.
Amazing.
It's good to know you're listening, Matt. And pictures or we won't believe you.
I think you need to send us in some pictures. I really want to see the quality of James'
that's
tailoring.
That's a lovely little radio
right
moment, though. The tailoring on that.
Really
right across the bat. And I bet he hasn't got the trousers, because if his thighs are still that size, I'd be absolutely amazed.
Can I ask you a tailor question?
Well, I don't know. Should we not do a little bit more on PMQs?
No, I want to ask, because you know Rishi Sunak was wore those suits which were quite a lot shorter, and it seems to be the trend these days for men to wear suits that were a lot shorter. Back in the day that you created these, was that not the case at all? I imagine
you have a half an inch between the welt on the shoe, which is where the sole joins the upper. You have a half inch between that and the bottom of the trousers.
So these were properly long, normal trousers?
Absolutely normal. I don't understand the short. I don't know why he does that. It doesn't make him look taller. It makes him look a bit silly. But anyway, on we go. So, it's probably going to be all Home Office, is it? There's not a lot else to do. And when Starmer will push back and say, well, it's your mess, and Kemi Badenoch will pretend that Rwanda was either a great success or it was about to be a great success.
I imagine that might come up too,
if only they just somehow believed a bit more.
Yeah, exactly.
We've given up believing in Britain and now we have to believe in Rwanda.
Well, speaking of Rishi Sunak, you know, there was that plane that was scheduled to go. He called the election and he decided not to let that plane go. So, you know, that's on Rishi Sunak's head. Why the Rwanda scheme never got off the tarmac was all due to him. He decided not to take that decision. So we'll never know whether it have worked, will we?
We'll never know.
We won't stop
hearing about how brilliant it would have been if only we had just believed a little bit more. And how many people actually went against their will to Rwanda after hundreds of millions of pounds had been spent?
I think, didn't we have two back from there?
I think it was a net loss. It was a minus two.
I think we had a few back from Rwanda, but I'm not sure we ever sent a single person there, apart from one or two people that wanted to go.
Voluntarily.
Voluntary, of course.
We will cross to the House of Commons as soon as the Leader of the Opposition, Kemi Badenoch, gets to her feet. I saw her this week, not in the flesh, looking happier than I have ever seen her look.
On the telly?
No.
On a news article? On the steam train.
Did you see that?
No.
She visited, I don't know, I hope it was the Severn Valley, actually, because they need all the promotion that they can get. A wonderful, wonderful tourist attraction in the West Midlands. I would recommend the Kidderminster to Bridgnorth trip, personally. But she was in the cabin of a steam train, and she looked genuinely childlike in her glee. It was quite touching, because I don't like her politics, but she must be under a hell of a lot of stress at the moment. Let's find out what she's got to say for herself today.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last year, in its manifesto, Labour promised not to increase income tax, not to increase national insurance, and not to increase VAT. Does the Prime Minister still stand by his promises?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm glad that the Leader of the Opposition is now finally talking about the economy. I can update the House, Mr. Speaker. Retail sales are higher than expected. Inflation is lower than expected. Growth has been upgraded this year. And, Mr. Speaker, the UK stock market is at an all-time high. The budget is on the 26th of November and we will lay out our plans. But I can tell the House now that we will build a stronger economy, we will cut NHS waiting lists and deliver a better future for our country.
Well, 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 Mr. Speaker. Yes. What a fascinating answer. It is not the same answer that I received when I asked exactly the same question word for word on the 9th of July. Then the Prime Minister replied with just one word, yes, and then he sat down with a smug grin on his face. What's changed in the past 4 months?
Mr. Speaker, as she well knows, no Prime Minister or Chancellor will ever set out their plans. But Mr. Speaker, I can say this. I can say this, Mr. Speaker, because the figures on the productivity review that's being undertaken, this is a judgment on their record in office. Those figures are now coming through, and they confirm that the Tories did even more damage to the economy than we previously thought.
Apologies.
Now, we will turn that around. We've already delivered the fastest growth in the G7 in the first half of this year. 5 interest rate cuts in a row. Trade deals with the US, EU and India. They broke the economy. We're fixing it.
Mr. Speaker, he says no Prime Minister or Chancellor will say these things before the budget. Has he told his Chancellor? Because she's been out there flying kites, causing constant speculation around the budget that is damaging the economy. All week, they've been briefing about tax rises. What we've heard is that he does not have a plan. So we have some ideas for him. Yes. Yesterday, they can... Yes. Mr. Speaker, it's quite clear that they need some ideas. Yeah. On this side of the house, we believe in scrapping taxes on family homes. Yesterday, we voted to abolish stamp duty. They voted against it. Even the Deputy Prime Minister, or the former Deputy Prime Minister, sorry, who resigned in disgrace for not paying stamp duty, voted to keep it. So, Mr. Speaker, I will remind them, on this side of the House, we know that abolishing stamp duty is how we get young people on the housing ladder and get the economy growing. So why won't he scrap this terrible tax?
Why didn't they do it then in 14 years in office? Mr. Speaker, as I said, the productivity review figures are now coming in, and they show the true extent of the damage that they did. And she asked us to take advice from them. We all know these figures are coming out. We all know that austerity damaged the economy on their watch. The botched Brexit deal damaged the economy on their watch. Liz Truss's mini-budget damaged the economy on their watch. So we'll take no lectures or advice from them on the economy. They won't be trusted on the economy for generations to come. Mr. Speaker, that's why at our budget, I can be clear, there'll be no return to austerity. That's what broke the country. No return to the instability of their mad borrowing spree. And we'll end the unfairness and low growth that squeeze living standards for working people. That's the path to national renewal.
Let me be not.
Mr. Speaker, Conservatives reduced the deficit every year until the pandemic. We more than doubled the personal allowance. We left 4 million more jobs than we found from Labour. We brought inflation down to 2%. It's nearly doubled.
Mr. Tufnell, you're in my sights. The pantomime season has arrived, so don't start it too early.
Mr. Speaker, on our record, we brought inflation down to 2%. It has doubled under him. We left him the fastest growing economy in the G7. It is no longer. The truth is, they have no ideas. We're giving them some. There is another way to get growth. It's cutting welfare spending and getting people into work. Last month, I offered to work cross-party with him to bring down welfare spending because he knows and we know that he'd rather dip into people's pockets than upset those people behind him. Instead of tax rises, will he work with us to find a way to cut welfare spending and get Britain working again?
Mr. Speaker, she talks about their record. Let's go through it. They crashed the economy. Inflation went up to 11%. Mortgages went through the roof. Welfare spending went up £33 billion on them, and they want to give us advice. And they reduced the UK to a laughing stock. Because of our budget, Mr. Speaker, waiting lists have come down, wages are up, mortgage rates are down, and other countries want to do deals with us. Just on Monday of this week, the Turkish government signed an £8 billion deal for typhoons. Earlier this year, the Norway government a £10 billion for frigates. That is because of the budget that we passed, fixing the mess that they left.
Mr. Speaker, it's not because of the budget that he passed. I started that deal back in January 2024. And I welcome it. There are some things, Mr. Speaker, It's got nothing to do with their budget. We're lucky it's still happening. So I welcome the £8 billion deal that he's done with Turkey, but I will remind him that just last month, his chancellor borrowed £20 billion. He'll have to sell a hell of a lot more jets to make up for that. And he won't rule out any tax rises. He can't cut spending. He is increasing unemployment. This man knows nothing about economic growth except how to destroy it. In his weakness, Mr. Speaker, he has caved into the unions with their regulations that will cripple businesses, costing them £5 billion every year. Yes, please do speak up, because I want every single business out there to hear Labour MP peace heckling when we talk about the damage that they are doing. So I ask the Prime Minister, how on earth can he consider adding more burdens for these firms to deal with?
Mr. Speaker, she's overlooked the fact that we had the highest growth in the G7 the first 6 months of this year, and that growth's just been upgraded. Three interest rate cuts. Mr. Speaker, we're not going to take lessons from them. She's now introduced what I understand to be, I think she calls it a golden economic rule, this golden rule that she's now putting forward, very golden. £47 billion, Mr. Speaker, of unspecified spending cuts with no detail whatsoever. Mr. Speaker, let me put that in context. That would be 85,000 fewer nurses, 234,000 fewer teachers, or cutting every police officer in the country twice over. No wonder the Institute for Government said she's on shaky foundations. That's exactly what caused the problem in the first place.
Can the man not?
Mr. Speaker, the fact that he has to stand there and make stuff up just shows what kind of Prime Minister he is. We had an itemised list. We had an itemised list of $47 billion. $23 billion was on welfare spending, which I asked him to work with us to cut. He refuses to do so. All he knows how to do is tax, tax, tax. If you work, they tax you more. If you save, they tax you more. If you buy a home, they tax you more. None of these taxes were in the manifesto, which he had 4 years to prepare. Mr. Speaker, he is raising taxes because he is too weak to control spending. Yeah. He's blaming us. He's blaming the OBR. Last week, they were blaming Brexit. Isn't the truth that with this Prime Minister, it's always someone else's fault? Yeah.
They were kicked out of office because they broke the economy. They won't be trusted for years to come. She can't tell us what her position is on the last budget. And she's got a phantom £47 billion with no foundation as we go forward. That's exactly the mess that they caused. They've not changed one bit. Meanwhile, we're fixing their mess. 5 million extra NHS appointments, 5 interest rate cuts, growth and wages up. That's a change the Labour government makes.
Kev Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As Palestinians try and rebuild their lives amid the rubble of Gaza, last night, once again, dozens of innocent people were killed by Israeli airstrikes. What will the UK do, along with our international partners, to hold the Netanyahu government to account for its actions? And what more can we do to ensure that aid gets in, as the IDF blocks aid in breach of both the peace agreement and international law?
Well, I thank him for raising this, and I'm deeply concerned, Mr. Speaker, by the strikes, and that underlines the fragility of the ceasefire deal. All sides need to uphold President Trump's peace plan. It is the only route to long-term peace for Israelis and Palestinians. We are, of course, in close touch with the US and regional allies, pushing for de-escalation. Mr. Speaker, the scale of destruction in Gaza is unimaginable. The immediate priority remains getting aid in at the speed and the volume needed. Thank you.
We come to the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Sir Ed Davey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And can I associate myself with what the Prime Minister said about Jamaica and indeed all those islands and countries affected by Hurricane Melissa? Our thoughts and prayers are with all those affected. And I'm sure the whole House will want to join me in paying tribute to Prunella Scales, Mr. Speaker. I suspect I'm not the only member of the House with a Fawlty Towers DVD box set. She will be greatly missed. Mr. Speaker, across Europe, in countries like Poland, Germany and France, we've seen evidence of dangerous Russian interference in their politics. Last month, the former leader of a major party in Wales pleaded guilty to taking bribes to make pro-Russian statements. The evidence shows Nathan Gill was a close confident of the current Reform Party leader for years. So does the Prime Minister agree with me that it's time we had an in-depth investigation into Russian meddling and money in British politics?
Join his comments on Pranell Scales. And on this question of Russian interference, it is a serious problem in countries across Europe, including in our country, where it's a constant threat. And Mr. Speaker, for NATO allies, the conflict in Ukraine and dealing with Russian aggression is the number one issue. And that is why I have to say the Reform Party would be an absolute disaster for our defence. We are a trusted member of NATO. We wouldn't be a trusted member if we were Putin-friendly. We are leading the coalition of the willing, giving security and comfort to 30 other countries. That would collapse under Reform because they're Putin-friendly, and it'd be a real threat to our defence and our security.
Sir Ed Davey.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for the Prime Minister's reply and I agree with him on Ukraine, but I do hope he will look at an investigation into this Russian interference in our politics. Mr. Speaker, last week I questioned how he can accept the damage of Brexit while refusing to do anything meaningful about it. The damage is clear, with the Financial Times reporting that lower productivity growth alone has blown a £20 billion black hole in the public finances. Just part of the Brexit black hole that Conservatives and Reform will not apologise for. Last week, he rejected my plan for a new customs union. So can I ask him what action he will take to change the Brexit deal, or is he just planning to complain about it?
Well, he must have overlooked the fact that there was a UK-EU summit earlier this year in which there were 10 strands to the change that we've already agreed in relation to relationship with the EU, including closer trading relationships, including closer work on defence and security, and that is an iterative process that we will continue into next year. But he's absolutely right about the botched deal of the last government, the damage that's done to our economy, and we're just seeing some of the figures coming through in relation to that. That's one of the reasons, or one of the factors behind the way they crash the economy.
Jonathan Brash.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
18 minutes after 12, and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. This is where we traditionally withdraw from PMQs, pause for a second, and then resume hostilities, or at least we start, Natasha and I start tracking the hostilities that we have just witnessed. I probably need to pay a little bit more attention to Ed Davey this week than we usually do, but you can stay tuned to find out.
This is LBC.
Oh! Hey, Mum, looks like someone's coming through the back gate.
Oh, it's not Barbara from judo again, is it? I can't listen to any more about her new boiler.
Or about the time she saw a ghost in her downstairs loo.
No, it's okay, look. It's just a dodgy-looking bloke in a hoodie.
Oh, thank God.
Hey, you, clear off! We know judo!
Always know who's at your door with Ring's new 4K security cameras. Available now at ring.com and Amazon.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4pm.
If you're in a position where another £1,000 to find is the difference between you going on holiday and you not going on holiday, I do actually think, for a week, the one family holiday you get to take that year is actually a good reason for you to miss school with your child.
Tom Swarbrick.
With cybersecurity from BT. Security solutions built for businesses.
LBC.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.5% AER variable. That includes a 2% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
Oh yeah, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that once-in-a-lifetime adventure. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.41% gross. Terms apply.
Why crawl when you can glide? Why stall when you can be dynamic? Agile, like a dolphin. The BYD Dolphin Surf is the compact car for the city. Register by 31st of December and this super smart hatchback can be yours for just £199 a month with £199 deposit and 0% APR. Visit BYD.com. T's and C's apply. Finance provided by Santander Consumer Finance. 49-month agreement. Optional final payment £6,771.38.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
21 minutes after 12 is the time. Let me rattle through a few texts. I'll begin by saying I thought that was pretty much honours even. I thought she started off ahead, actually. Keir Starmer kind of caught her up, and thanks to Ed Davies' intervention, it ended up being a score draw. Matt disagrees. He says Badenoch is having a nightmare here. Bruce writes, I don't know why I put myself through this. I thought she was supposed to get better every week. She's still not landing any blows, but her fighting style, says James, is becoming a lot more fun. Keir and Kemi are a proper odd couple. God, I'm tired of these answers, writes Ben, with no detail from Starmer. And John asks, did my ears deceive me? Or did I hear someone on the benches shouting, move on, as Ed Davey questioned the impact of Brexit? I didn't pick it up myself, John, but almost certainly. Everybody who encouraged the country to vote for Brexit is now absolutely adamant that we should never talk about it anymore. Indeed, as with Trump derangement syndrome, which is a phrase used to describe people who don't like self-confessed sex offenders, felons, criminals, and inciters of attacks upon democracy itself, Brexit derangement syndrome is a phrase deployed by people who told you to vote for something that has made you poorer, has made your country less powerful, has diminished your nation in every imaginable way, but they don't really want to talk about that anymore. Just in case there are any doubt at all about where those phrases come from. I said score draw, Natasha. What do you say?
Yeah, I agree with you there, James. She did start off quite strong, but it just felt like a little bit of a sort of rinse and repeat of greatest hits. You know, maybe she's been listening closely to our commentary where we say that usually she's strong when she's talking about the economy. And to be fair, there could have been a big moment that we might have just witnessed at Prime Minister's Questions there. He did not commit to keeping his manifesto promise not to raise VAT, income tax or national insurance. And as we know, and as Kemi Badenoch pointed out, he did do that to her at previous Prime Minister's questions. So is this a big hint that we are about to see a huge rise?
Stop trying to dress it up. Of course, if you're going to put income tax up, I bet you 50p.
Maybe.
I bet you 50p.
Well, okay. Yeah, I'll take
are we allowed to do bets on there?
I'm not sure.
Is that against the law? I don't know.
Take it back. Yeah. But
If
I were the government, look, they're 4 weeks out from the budget. They've not nailed down anything yet. And I think that if you are a politically savvy government, you might want to at least threaten a rise in income tax before actually at the budget being able to say, oh no, I managed to find the money elsewhere.
Yeah, true.
Lots of governments lead us up the garden path only to say, oh no, actually we decided not to do that. We decided to save you all from the horror of an income tax rise. But it is interesting that from Keir Starmer that he could not commit to that when pointedly he is previously committed to it. And equally, if you indeed are right, James, how do you sell a breaking of a manifesto promise like that? Do you, as Keir Starmer appears to be doing, blame Brexit, blame the government's
trade
deals?
Things are worse than we realise.
Yeah, but were they not worse than we realised last year? Were they not, you know, Donald Trump's tariffs?
They're even worse than we realised.
Yeah, but Donald...
Ask me again. They're even worse than we realised. They're even more worse than we realised. That's how they'll do it.
What do you pin it to? If you have an excuse and you have to say there is a reason why we are having to raise your taxes now, we are going to have to pin it on something. I think... I'm not saying that you can't blame it on Brexit. However, it happened a little while ago, and many people will say, and as you heard in their Patroon pre-MQs, is this something that's not happening anymore?
I think she'd appear, wouldn't she?
Yeah, you heard from Keir Starmer then.
Front page of the Daily Star.
Blame
lettuce,
Liz Trump.
What lettuce? They've been listening to Liz Truss so that you don't have to. Apparently, she doesn't read papers. And she was too good as Prime Minister. That's why they got rid of her and we invented
sounds
America.
Right. Yeah, sounds about right. Yeah.
This is wonderful stuff. So, I mean, I know it's a rhetorical question, but the fiscal black hole, I think putting it in the manifesto was utterly unnecessary and a really stupid political move by Labour. They didn't need to do that. There was absolutely no reason for it.
I've changed my mind on that one. I think at the time I thought, great, this is a really good thing to show that Labour are really strong on the economy and they're not going to... Yeah, and I think
it was Ming Vars.
Yeah,
actually,
for sure.
But actually, it turns out that they sustained a small fracture in the Ming Vars when they did that, because I'm 99.9% certain they will have to abandon it. And
it's really hard to maintain a promise that big, which takes up so much of the tax take. Mm. Something like, what is it, 75% to 80% of the tax take is on those three main taxes for 5 years, when you don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, it's fair to say that the Labour government didn't expect Donald Trump to be re-elected, did they? And obviously that he's come in, caused a huge tariff war, completely unsettled the global economy. But equally, it's been 6 months since then, and this government have not wanted to blame Donald Trump for the reason why there is a huge loophole in the public finances, even partly. So I think they're going to find it really hard to sell the fact they're breaking this manifesto promise. And I don't know how many people are going to accept the idea that it's Liz Truss, Brexit, Donald Trump are to blame.
Fiscal black hole. And of course, you know, if they say unforeseen circumstances, then they also look stupid because they would be, well, you were coming into government and you didn't realise there'd be unforeseen circumstances.
Exactly.
You don't, yeah, and they still would have won. Oh, but I can't imagine there would have been many votes lost if they hadn't put that in the
Totally agree with you now. Obviously, in hindsight, it's easier for us to say, isn't it?
Of course.
But I agree. It was a really, really tricky one.
Everyone knows we've got to raise, unless you're Cammy Badenoch, pretending that you can find it down the back of a sofa.
Well, this government's big stick going into this budget, I'm told, is no return to austerity. We're not going to do that again. We're not going to cut spending, even though you've obviously got departments where, you know, spending has increased. You talk a lot about the welfare department, and it's categorically objective to say that budget is spiralling higher and higher and higher, and this government don't seem to want to be able to grip that. And is that something that this government wants to do? Absolutely not. They talk a lot about how they want to save and cut down the flab, but actually they don't want to return to austerity. They say that is a politically unpalatable argument for them to make.
And Matt has answered your question, although there's a difference between what is observable statistics and, of course, political movements and feelings. Figures have emerged that show just how much more disastrous than originally thought both Brexit and the Tories were for our economy. That is what they will argue, but it won't necessarily butter some of the parsnips that they're keen to see buttered. And enter Ed Davey.
Yeah, he was... sorry, I can see the love hearts that you've written around Ed Davey's name on
those
your
Those are two of my favourite subjects, obviously. Telling the truth about Brexit and finding out just how much Russian influence there has been in the... body politic.
Yeah, and the MP before him noted Israel as well. I thought that the breaking of the potential breaking of the ceasefire, the fragile peace agreement potentially disintegrating might be something that Ed Davey would raise. We saw that from a Labour MP instead. And you saw Ed Davey again talking about the case of Nathan Gill, obviously a close ally of Nigel Farage. He would like to disassociate himself from him now, but it's fair to say they were very, very, very close.
They were bezies.
And I said this to you previously. I think that the argument that reform would be a disaster for defence, as Keir Starmer made, was a very strong one there, and I think that does work. A lot of people, I think, will be unwilling to trust Nigel Farage, given his links, and given his links to people like Nathan Gill.
And his well-documented admiration and hero worship of Vladimir Putin.
Exactly, and he really changed. I don't know if you saw that Bloomberg interview that he did last week or the year before, where he was talking about defence, talking about Russia. Really seemed to me to be a big shift in his policy.
Surely not.
The
father of integrity, consistency and truth. Completely backtracking and reverse ferreting on something he insisted was true just 2 minutes ago.
Yeah, but it felt a really big shift, and he said, you know, if I were Prime Minister, I would let, you know, people shoot down Russian drones or planes or whatever it might be. It felt to me like a bit of a step change from him, and like you say, he has been shaky on the issue of Russian defence.
He will blow in whatever direction he thinks the tastiest morsels lie, always has done, always will do, and for a long time they appeared to lie in the Kremlin, or at least that's what he dedicated an awful lot of political energy to defending and supporting. Of course, in his defence, some people don't need to be bribed to talk up Kremlin talking points in the European Parliament.
It's true.
Some people will do it for free.
Some people. Well, I can't comment on who that might be.
Well, so
they're going through court cases at this time. But we can only speculate.
Yes, indeedy. I've got a little bit more on that, actually. We've done a little bit of work on the Nathan Gill story and, indeed, Nigel Farage's interventions in public discourse from similar perspectives, which you can listen to from 12:45. Simon Marks will be with us after the very latest news headlines. But in conclusion, oddly enough, Ed Davey probably won that one.
I think he did. Score draw between Kemi Badenoch and Keir Starmer, all in all, a bit of a boring rinse and repeat, unless that manifesto promise is indeed broken in the budget, and that will be the moment where it is broken. Okay, well,
it's going to be broken.
I won't bet you 50p.
Can you think of a sport? Well, I suppose rowing in a way, where there are three teams.
You're going to row back?
No, I'm just trying. Of course, there's lots of things where there's three teams. I just meant teams. So you don't have the third option winning very often, as it were. But Ed Davey probably made the most substantive contribution to PMQs this week. Kemi Badenoch was better than last week, but not as good as
not as good as some of her greatest hits. I think she was fine last week. That she was quite strong in some points. But this one, it just felt like she wasn't able to press beyond the first question. She wasn't really able to take it on too much this week.
And Starmer was just a bit boring.
He was fine.
Just
yeah,
a bit dull. And I've heard it all before.
Just a bit boring.
Why don't you tell me something I don't know. You've both forgotten, writes James, how wafer thin, Labour's winning majority actually was. If it had left itself vulnerable to tax and spend claims, then many of those tentative Labour constituency wins may not have got across the line.
You make a point. They had
a
very shallow win for Labour, of course. Many constituencies where they just about got over the line there. So
Labour are putting your taxes up, lose votes, so they have to say, no, we're not, even if then they do.
Exactly.
Showbiz. It's 12:31. Thomas Watts has your headlines.
Sir Keir Starmer has described the scenes of destruction after Hurricane Melissa as truly shocking. He's told MPs that Britain is ready to provide humanitarian support to Jamaica, where officials are assessing the damage. It's understood the sex offender Hadish Kabatu was paid a discretionary £500 to be swiftly deported to Ethiopia. The asylum seeker was released from HMP Chelmsford by mistake last Friday. Leading economists and academics have warned child poverty is causing long-term economic damage. A letter to Rachel Reeves, and seen by LBC, says the two-child benefit cap must be overturned in the budget. LBC weather. Sunshine and showers for many places. Strong winds and occasionally heavy rain further north. A high of 14 degrees.
This is LBC.
Sandy!
Where's? You're looking chirpy.
This gloomy weather is perfect for the London Dungeon. Got a great deal of SWR rewards.
Great minds think alike. I'm off to get a bird's eye view from St. Paul's.
You are such a culture vulture.
Wes!
Make every trip a treat with SWR rewards. Book a train from Chilworth today to claim yours. Southwestern Railway. Spread your wings. T's and C's apply.
Shop kitchen deals right now at AO. Save big on ovens, hobs, fridge freezers and much more from brands like Hisense, AEG and Hotpoint. No wonder we're the UK's most trusted electrical retailer. Shop now at AO.com. Verify most trusted at AO.com/trust.
Have you noticed the way fans shout at football matches?
Oh, wake up!
That's because conveying your message with sound is the most effective way to communicate to the players on the pitch that they're rubbish. And this works in advertising too. You see, research shows how brands that use radio to amplify their advertising are 49% more likely to get noticed. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
You were a soldier one day and you're a civvy the next.
I lost my friends, my accommodation, and everything that I was proud of. I lost myself.
I didn't tell anybody how dark things were.
These are the battles you don't see. Help for Heroes stands with veterans and their families every day, providing life-changing support that rebuilds lives. It's not just their fight, it's ours too. Together, we must help veterans find the peace they deserve. Search Help for Heroes today.
James O'Brien on LBC.
12:34 is the time. Donald Trump is trumping all over the United States of America and our sometimes vain but often successful attempts to try to keep track of the extent of the horror and the madness continue imminently with Simon Marks. Remember that if you are troubled by any of the appalling abuses currently being visited upon the United States of America and, of course, the wider world, then you are not somebody concerned about decency, democracy and the welfare of fellow human beings. You are suffering from something called Trump derangement syndrome. There was something similar, I think, in the 1930s. Another political figure, and if you had a problem with what he was up to long before he committed his worst excesses, then you were suffering from his derangement syndrome. No one ever suffers from Simon Marks' derangement syndrome. We can't get enough of him. Shall we start in New York?
I think that's a good idea, James, because certainly there are many people in the United States that have Zoran Mamdani derangement syndrome. Zoran Mamdani is going to become the next mayor of New York City next week. November the 4th is election day, and there's no question about the outcome of this race. He is the Democratic Party's candidate. He will cruise to victory. He will very easily dispose of his opponents, the Republican candidate, Curtis Curtis Sliwa. You may remember he of the Guardian Angels, the vigilantes that took to the New York subway system, if you're old enough to remember, back in the 1980s to try and clean it up. And he's also going to vanquish the former mayor, the former governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, who is running to be the mayor of New York City in a completely failed bid to try and revive his own political fortune. So Zoran Mamdani, a democratic socialist, as he describes himself, is going to become not only the first Muslim mayor of New York City, but also the first Indian American mayor of New York City. But it's the democratic socialist bit that has got his critics absolutely engaged in paroxysms of fear about the kind of government that he plans to oversee once he takes the reins of power in the Gracie Mansion in New York.
To the point where Rupert Murdoch media in this country has ended up rather embarrassed because of their desperation, apparently, to undertake a hit job upon the future mayor of New York. Have you seen this story in the about the Bill de Blasio?
Yes.
I know you have. It's theatre, Simon. I'm just building up a little bit of tension. This is actually breathtaking. I can't remember seeing anything like this before in my life.
It's extraordinary. This is Bill de Blasio, the former Democrat mayor of New York City, himself pretty controversial for his tenure, which is widely considered, even by Democrats, a failure when he ran things in New York City. But earlier today, the Times, our Times,
the Times of London,
yes, as they always refer to it in the United States, published an interview with Bill de Blasio criticizing Zoran Mamdani, which came as a bit of a surprise, given that Bill de Blasio has been a steadfast supporter of the aforementioned democratic socialist who's about to become the next mayor of the city. Well, it turns out that the Times appears to have been taken by some kind of scammer, because they've now, as far as I can understand it, removed the page from their website after Bill de Blasio put out a furious statement saying he never spoke to the newspaper, absolutely never spoke to the reporter in question, wanted to make it 100% clear that the views that were being published on the Times website were not his views about Zoran Mamdani, that he's completely lined up behind Mr. Mamdani's populist, radical, left-wing agenda, and it certainly looks as though the Times has been taken in
by an impersonator.
By someone who was impersonating Bill de Blasio. I mean, we've seen this before on various occasions with other politicians in the United States who have been taken in on various radio talk shows and things like that, but it's pretty extraordinary.
Well, it's different
coming
on the
as
radio.
Close as it has done to the election. Yeah, of course.
And you can hear John Coleshaw's recent full disclosure where he recalls the time he rang Downing Street pretending to be William Hague and got put straight through to Tony Blair, much to his own shock and surprise. Just to step out, staying with Donald Trump, but stepping out of the United States for a moment, when is a ceasefire not a ceasefire?
Well, that's the big question. When is peace in Gaza not peace in Gaza? And when is one of the eight wars that you've claimed that you have historically brought to an end actually about to start reviving? I mean, I think the events of the last few hours in Gaza and Israel's airstrikes on the territory again indicates the fragility, not just of the ceasefire, but of the entire 20-point peace plan that Donald Trump put forward. I mean, I think there's no question that, you know, on Monday a week ago, when the hostages, the living hostages, were being returned from Gaza, and Donald Trump made that triumphant visit to the Middle East, not just to Israel, but also to Sharm el-Sheikh, of course, in Egypt. You know, he was justifiably taking what appeared to be a lap of victory, but it was a premature lap of victory, especially given the fact that whatever the outcome of this new outbreak of hostilities between the two sides, there are still vast numbers of unanswered questions. How on earth is Hamas going to be demilitarized? The White House cannot answer that question. Donald Trump insists it is absolutely going to happen one way or the other, either they give up their weapons, or he says, we're going to go in there and take them from them. But who's the we here? Because he also says American boots aren't going to be put on the ground in Gaza. And that's just one element before you get to the question of what does the day after look like in Gaza? What does governance in Gaza really look like? This board of peace headed by Donald Trump with Tony Blair playing a pretty hefty role on the ground, according to the proposals that he's discussed with US officials. In practical terms, what does that look like? And how much longer is the president really going to be able to say, I solved the war, when perhaps he didn't?
Reports of over 100 dead, of course, in Gaza, including reportedly dozens of children. Israel claimed that an Israeli soldier was shot by Hamas, but Hamas dispute that claim, and foreign journalists are still not allowed to go into the territory in order to provide some form of objectivity and clarity on these always confused and conflicting accounts. It's gone one of those days where we're not going to cover everything because there aren't enough hours in the day, so you choose what in order of importance. Simon, what's next?
I think we should talk about the government shutdown, yes, because we're almost a month into it now, and it's really going to begin to bite in the next few days. Food stamps recipients aren't going to be getting any more of their food assistance from the US government. That is literally going to leave people hungry in the lowest levels of income earners across the United States. Federal government workers aren't being paid. They have no idea whether, for example, their mortgage providers are going to offer forbearance against late payments or whether traditional penalties are going to apply. I heard from one federal government worker yesterday who texted me and said, I am angry all the time because there is, I think, tremendous tension now among hundreds of thousands of these civil service families. And take a listen to what Donald Trump said while he was in Asia yesterday, while he was in Japan, about where exactly he thinks this shutdown might be going. Because the thing to understand about all of this is that it's not accidental. It is by design. He leads a government, is his director of the Office of Management and Budget before they came into office, said that creating trauma among government civil servants was the aim. They view these government civil servants as the enemy within the US government. And listen to what Donald Trump said yesterday about Congress. He was arguing that when he put together that huge big spending and legislative proposal, the so-called big beautiful bill that he's now signed into law, well, as far as he was concerned, that was his relationship with Congress pretty much done and dusted.
I said, put it all into one bill, and if we get it done, we're done for 4 years. We don't need anything more from Congress in terms of that, right, Scott? We got it all done. It was a little risky, but because if we didn't get it done, I don't know, who knows what would happen with these radical left lunatics that we have to deal with.
So he absolutely relishes this shutdown, doesn't have anything to worry about as far as, from his perspective, Congress is concerned, has no need for it, he suggested there going forward, because this is giving him the opportunity once again to try and prove that the powers of the presidency are unlimited. Even the fact, James, that he is in Asia preparing for that all-important meeting with President Xi Jinping of China tomorrow, even that is extraordinary. Most American presidents wouldn't leave the country and make a huge international trip at a time when the government was shut down. They'd be here trying to get it reopened. Donald Trump loves this shutdown, and he is very unconcerned about whether it comes to an end, even though some of the developments over the next few days are further going to depress his numbers in the opinion polls, because all those families impacted by all of these funding cuts and furloughed pay packets are going to get very angry very quickly.
It's easy to see why your contact is so angry already, with more on the way. And I can't believe this, but this is the only way I can phrase the question. They've killed more people without any evidence of wrongdoing.
Yes, they have. Absolutely. Four more boats. There were varying reports yesterday, three or four boats in the Caribbean blown out of the water yesterday, in the Pacific, actually, they said yesterday. Okay. Once again, providing no evidence at all to support their claims advanced by the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, that these boats were carrying drug traffickers to United States shores. I mean, we just have to apparently believe that because he said it. He hasn't provided any evidence to support it. 14 people killed. I believe one survivor was recovered in the waters after those attacks rained down on those maritime vessels. And every indication that the government of Donald Trump is still planning to launch airstrikes on what they claim are drug trafficking operations on Venezuelan soil. I mean, the maritime stuff is all extrajudicial, and they don't even pretend that it's covered under international law. If they do start launching airstrikes on Venezuelan soil, the Venezuelan government will view that as an act of war and a direct assault on the country's sovereignty, despite the lack of democratic qualifications that President Nicolas Maduro enjoys in Caracas.
And finally, the head of Border Patrol finally receiving a little bit of pushback from a judge in Chicago. Bovino,
well,
the rather stressful nominative determinism, isn't it, in action?
Absolutely amazing story. This is Greg Bovino. He is the head of the Border Patrol. And remember that Donald Trump is slowly giving more authority to the Border Patrol in terms of the mass deportation program and taking some authority away from ICE, the Immigration Customs and Enforcement Division. Bovino, and I mean, I'm saying this objectively, he has been strutting around Chicago like he owns the place. He's always dressed in fatigues. He was seen on video lobbing a tear gas grenade at a crowd of protesters exercising their constitutionally protected First Amendment rights to demonstrate against U.S. government policy. He displays an arrogance and a cockiness that I think is unmatched in the field, even by the standards of Donald Trump's usually masked and thuggish operatives. Well, a judge literally yesterday ordered him to start appearing before a court in Chicago every night, every weeknight at 6 p.m. going forward, because she says she wants a report on his activities and the activities of the Border Patrol in an effort to make sure that the kind of danger that she argues they pose to civilians in Chicago by chucking this tear gas around willy-nilly is immediately headed off. So it's going to be very interesting to see if he turns up tonight and what kind of sanctions will be leveled against him if he either fails to turn up or if he continues to act in the absolutely indiscriminate way in which he's been acting over the last few days.
Oh, I said there was a lot to get through, and we probably haven't got through all of it, but we've done a pretty good job, Simon, thanks to you. We will talk again soon, and that I think that is the thing to watch. I mean, it's so hard, isn't it, for me to say to you, or for Simon to say to you, that's the thing you need to watch most closely. Is it the shutdown? Is it the extrajudiciary murders, essentially, that are being undertaken without any rationale or reference to international law in the seas around America? Or is it the deployment of essentially sort of armed agents on the streets of American cities under the lie that they are in peril or unsafe? He said more than the National Guard will be deployed on American streets next. And the massive majority of the people that Bovino's operatives are targeting are American citizens. So even the immigration argument has gone out of the window now. It is 12:48. That question from Ed Davey, I'll remind you of it shortly. Something that adds to my sense that an awful lot of people who do what I do for a living are absent without leave when it comes to some of the stories that we should all be exercised by.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
Economists sound an alarm bell over child poverty. Breakfast clubs are all very well, but isn't not being poor better? Is it time for the government to really invest in the poorest children?
Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
Fishing. It's a wonderful way to spend an afternoon, but it could also be a huge threat to your business. Phishing emails are scams that trick you into giving away vital data, putting your company at risk. So how do you make sure you don't get caught, hook, line and sinker? Just ask BT.
The world is vast. offering endless possibilities. But Claire's world has only been getting smaller. She doesn't leave the country. She barely leaves the house. Still traumatized by that roadside bomb in Iraq. More than 20 years ago. For many, the battle continues. Combat Stress provides intensive mental health treatment to UK veterans with complex mental health problems, helping them rediscover the world they once knew. Combat Stress, for veterans' mental health. Search Combat Stress to support our work.
At TfL, we're helping to make bus journeys greener. Our entire bus fleet is 100% low or zero emission at the tailpipe, including those for our Superloop routes, helping improve air quality for all. And we'll have a fully zero emission fleet by 2034. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
It's easy to forget just how crazy things have been over the past couple of years. Every day we wake up to something new. Tariffs and taxes on anything and everything. It's tempting to put your hands in your ears and go, la 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 la, I can't hear you, until it's all over. But you know what's the best response to crazy times? A plan for your money. And Quilter can help. Because let's face it, there's probably going to be some crazy times ahead too. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
You asked, BT answered.
With phishing, awareness makes all the difference. Train your staff to spot suspicious emails and encourage them to slow down. Hackers rely on you being in a rush, so slowing down decreases your risk.
Cybersecurity is everyone's business. Search BT Business Cybersecurity to find out more.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
12:51 is the time. Ed Davey probably emerged from PMQs this week with a little more credit than either of the two major party leaders, not least because of this intervention.
Mr. Speaker, across Europe, in countries like Poland, Germany and France, we've seen evidence of dangerous Russian interference in their politics. Last month, the former leader of a major party in Wales pleaded guilty to taking bribes to make pro-Russian statements. The evidence shows Nathan Gill was a close confidant of the current Reform Party leader for years. So does the Prime Minister agree with me that it's time we had an in-depth investigation into Russian meddling and money in British politics?
Joining us, comments on Pranell Scales. And on this question of Russian interference, it is a serious problem in countries across Europe, including in our country, where it's a constant threat. And Mr. Speaker, for NATO allies, the conflict in Ukraine and dealing with Russian aggression is the number one issue. And that is why I have to say the Reform Party would be an absolute disaster for our defence. We are a trusted member of NATO. We wouldn't be a trusted member if we were Putin-friendly. We are leading the coalition of the willing, giving security and comfort to 30 other countries. That would collapse under Reform because they're Putin-friendly, and it'd be a real threat to our defence and our security.
Sir Ed Davey. Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for the Prime Minister's reply, and I agree with him on Ukraine, but I do hope he will look at an investigation into this Russian interference in our politics.
That would be a good idea, an investigation, wouldn't it? Well, let's have a look at two of the characters that Ed Davey just talked about. Nathan Gill, who has been convicted of receiving bribes from Kremlin stooges, and Nigel Farage, who hasn't. Here is the latter speaking in March of 2014 in the European Parliament.
This EU empire, ever seeking to expand, stated its territorial claim on the Ukraine some years ago. Just to make that worse, of course, some NATO members said they too would like the Ukraine to join NATO. We directly encouraged the uprising in the Ukraine that led to the toppling of the President Yanukovych, and that led, of course, in turn to Vladimir Putin reacting. And the moral of the story is if you poke the Russian bear with a stick, don't be surprised when he reacts.
That, as I keep stressing, is categorically not the man who has been convicted of taking bribes from a Kremlin stooge in order to punt Kremlin, pro-Kremlin talking points in the European Parliament. That chap is called Nathan Gill, and here he is speaking in the European Parliament in the same year, just a few months later.
The first attempt led to the overthrow of the democratically elected pro-Russian president and the current civil war which we have now in the Ukraine. With Putin up in his rhetoric, where is this going to end? The Ukraine is a buffer zone between NATO and Russia. The EU is taking away this buffer zone, potentially putting NATO tanks on the border with Russia. What you are doing today is throwing petrol onto the bonfire that the EU lit. Putin is not the biggest threat to our civilization. The biggest threat is Muslim extremists. This is for political reasons, and poking the Russian bear is very dangerous. For this reason, UKIP voted against this agreement.
Also, of course, voted against attempts to outlaw Russian propaganda from European media. Just to stress again, the first voice you heard has categorically not been convicted of taking bribes from a Kremlin stooge to raise pro-Kremlin talking points in the European Parliament. But the second voice you heard, Nathan Gill, not Nigel Farage, has been convicted of that. Both sound like admirers of Vladimir Putin, don't they? I wonder who the biggest admirer is.
I don't admire Putin. What I said was he'd outwitted and outclassed you all over Syria. I also said I didn't like him as a human being and I wouldn't want to live in Russia. Let's not meddle.
Hang on, just before you go on, you did actually say you admired him.
As an operator, not as a human being.
The question was, which current world leader do you most admire? As an operator, I would say Putin.
Yes.
So lying there, David Dimbleby reminding some of his successors at the BBC how you hold liars to account when they are lying. He's also perhaps lied about his closeness to or knowledge of or fondness for Nathan Gill, the man who has been convicted of taking bribes from Kremlin stooges for raising pro-Kremlin points in the European Parliament. Categorically not the case that Nigel Farage, who delivered a speech in the same year sounding rather similar, has not been convicted of taking any bribes from the Kremlin. Indeed, there is no suggestion whatsoever that he has, although some people may want to ask some questions. I am certainly not one of those people. I will ask, though, whether it's true that he barely knew Nathan Gill, as one of his more modern colleagues claimed.
But in particular, it's a big victory for Nathan Gill, our leader in Wales, an honest, decent, honourable man who's been loyal to me and the party at all times. Nathan, you've led UKIP Wales into this, and well done you.
Now known, of course, to Nigel Farage as Nathan Who. But no doubt there about precisely who Nathan Gill was. And talking of lying, it's always worth reminding ourselves of how it operates and how easy it is to make claims that are simply not true if the person you're making them to hasn't done their homework.
The ever eastward expansion of NATO and the European Union was giving this man a reason to his Russian people to say they're coming for us again and to go to war.
But you were echoing him. You were echoing him. That's what Putin says.
No. Sorry, I've been saying this actually since the 1990s. Ever since the war. But hang on a second. We've provoked this war. Of course it's his fault. He's used what
we've
done.
But we provoked the invasion of Ukraine.
Yes, and very interestingly, once again, 10 years ago when I predicted this, by the way, I'm the only person in British politics that predicted what would happen. And of course, everyone said I was a pariah for daring to suggest it. George Robertson, former Labour cabinet minister, who went on to become the Secretary General of NATO, has in the last couple of weeks said the war is a direct result of EU expansionism.
George Robertson later clarified that he had done nothing of the sort and responded to Farage's misinterpretation of his statement, Lord Robertson, by saying that Farage was parroting the Kremlin line. But for the avoidance of doubt, that clip came from Panorama, for the avoidance of doubt, Nigel Farage has categorically not been convicted in court of parroting Kremlin lines after receiving bribes from Kremlin stooges, but Nathan Gill, who delivered a very similar sounding speech in the same parliament just a few months previously, absolutely has. And some people will respond to Ed Davies' point in parliament today by questioning whether there is any need for a further inquiry, a deeper inquiry into Russian interference in UK politics. But remember, I'm just asking questions. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date on the top stories and opinions, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, as well as listen to a range of podcasts, including Full Disclosure with Charles Dance this week and James O'Brien Daily. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store. Now, Tom Swarbrick with you at 4 on LBC, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you very much, James. At 3 today, as the morning after pill becomes free of charge from here on in, is there widespread misinformation or just poor information and guidance for girls and women on contraceptives, like the pill, for example, but other examples too? Talk about that at 3. At 2, you get housing right, you get healthier people, happier people, more working people, more productive people, more jobs. Will we ever get housing right? We're certainly not at the moment. But I start with a warning, an alarm bell, if you will, from economists and academics over child poverty. They're urging Rachel Reeves to drop the child benefit cap policy. They say it makes people poorer and damages the economy in the longer term. Is it time for the government to really invest in the poorest children in our country?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, Sir Keir Starmer has described the scenes of destruction after Hurricane Melissa as truly shocking. The Prime Minister says Britain is ready to support Jamaica, where officials are assessing the damage. Hundreds of thousands of people are without power as a result of catastrophic winds and flash flooding. Addressing MPs in the Commons this lunchtime, Sir Keir says resources are being made available to help those in need.
Both the Foreign Secretary and I have been in close contact with our Jamaican counterparts in recent days to offer the UK's full support. Mr Speaker, I can update the House that HMS Trent and specialist rapid deployment teams are pre-positioned in the region, and we stand ready to provide humanitarian support.
Melissa has now arrived in Cuba as a weaker Category 3 storm. It's understood the sex offender Harish Kabatu was paid £500 to be swiftly deported to Ethiopia. The asylum seeker was released from HMP Chelmsford by mistake last Friday. LBC's political editor Natasha Clark is following the story.
The reason, they say it's a discretionary £500 payment. It sounds like, reading between the lines, it was basically because they thought he might kick off or launch a legal challenge. And it's not an uncommon thing. We do it a lot, obviously, in the eyes of Home Office officials who have authorised this payment, worth giving him that money to get him out of the country.
Israel says the Gaza ceasefire is back in effect after it carried out strikes on the territory yesterday. Palestinian officials say more than 100 people were killed. Israel carried out the attacks after accusing Hamas of targeting Israeli troops. More than 40 economists and policy experts have urged Rachel Reeves to scrap the two-child benefit cap. A letter seen by LBC says it's become the largest driver of rising child poverty and must be overturned in full at the budget. President Trump has arrived in South Korea ahead of his anticipated meeting tomorrow with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. Speaking in the city of Gangju, Mr. Trump said he was looking forward to securing a great trade deal between the US and China. Both nations are looking to avoid further escalation in a trade war. And women are now able to get the morning after pill free of charge in pharmacies across England. Emergency contraception was already free for most GPs and sexual health clinics, but costs up to £30 from chemists. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 78 at 97.95. The pound buys $1.32 and €1.13. LBC weather. Sunshine and showers for many, some heavy downpours further north with strong winds this afternoon. A high of 14 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
We were a noisy generation.
but it might be something quiet we do that becomes our greatest legacy. Leave a gift in your will to the British Heart Foundation and fund groundbreaking research that could help save millions of lives. Search BHF Wills.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. I think it's fair to say we are very much in the run-in, maybe the long run-in, but certainly the run-in to the budget on the 26th of November, less than a month away now. And it's going to be some budget because of the real demands on Rachel Reeves and on the economy and therefore on the rest of us, on you and me. And today, a group of economists and academics have sounded something of an alarm bell to Rachel Reeves over child poverty, specifically child benefits, and even more specifically, the two-child benefit cap. I'm conscious that this government has done some things to help families in poverty or in difficulty, things like breakfast clubs or some schools providing lunch as well, free school lunches for all of their kids too, is an important bit of assistance, and there are other examples of it too. But wouldn't it be better for them not to be in poverty at all? Yes, is the answer clearly to that question. Wouldn't it be better if childcare was more affordable and especially mothers could work more to support their families than they currently can because of the costs of childcare, for example? There's all kinds of things bearing down on families and creating poverty. But there's a widespread agreement that, I mean, not everybody thinks this, but there is widespread agreement that that two-child benefit cap is an easy, not fix, but an easy alleviator of poverty for those who are poorest. Is it time for the government to really invest, very explicitly invest, in the poorest children? If you're affected by this, it'd be great to hear from you as well. 0345 6060 973, the number to call. You can text 84850. Natasha Clark joins me to talk about this. We'll hear from Megan Meek O'Connor in just a moment, head of policy at Save the Children UK. Natasha, this has been rumbling for a long time, hasn't it? This push on that particular policy, the child benefit cap, the two-child benefit cap.
Yeah, especially, and if you talk to Labour MPs, this is one that they feel so passionately about. And when you think about, you know, the fact that Keir Starmer, in the eyes of some, is really trying to differentiate himself from the last Tory government, this is something that which they say, you know, this will make us so different to the last government who put limits on benefits and did, they say, little to tackle child poverty. And this is one of the policies that keeps coming back time and time again. And we know that people in government want to get rid of it too. We know that Keir Starmer privately wants to get rid of it. We know Bridget Phillipson wants to get rid of it. And it's all about the economics of whether they can afford to do so. And he has said repeatedly, when the economic conditions allow. It's fair to say the economic conditions at the moment do not allow. Rachel Reeves facing a huge 20 to 30 billion pound black hole at the moment.
It's an easy one for people like me and you and for opposition politicians to push back at them on, isn't it? Because I think I'm right saying the figure would be about 4 billion, the cost of this.
It's exactly right. 4 billion. For lifting this two-child limit is around £3.5 billion a year. But interestingly, this story that I'm bringing to you today, the economists that have joined together to write this letter, including people who previously worked for the DWP, they also include people who were on the government's child poverty task force. So people within government and who are working closely with
government. Who understand the levers that can be pulled.
Yeah, who get it. But what I thought was really interesting from this letter that they've written to the Chancellor was they believe the wider cost to the economy of child poverty is far, far more. They say it can be up to £39 billion a year that's costing us. They talk about lost productivity, reduced tax revenues, higher public spending on health and education. So they say that overall, this is going to be far, far eclipsed if you lift this cap. I'm told that the Treasury is looking at a number of options. Of course they are. If they were to lift the two-child benefit cap and the sort of benefits cap, which the overall benefits cap, which the government put on, that's going to cost around £4.5 billion a year. And it's fair to say that,
combined,
yes, if you put those two things together, which is exactly what they're calling for in this letter. It's fair to say if Rachel Reeves is already facing such a high black hole to fill,
£5 billion is quite a large amount, right, in order to fill that. So they are looking at a number of different options, I'm told. I was speaking to people in government yesterday that say, you know, they are looking at a halfway house option, essentially, which could limit benefits to maybe the first three or four children, but not to others, so not for larger families, and some sort of tapering system where it starts out at one end and goes to the other, rather than scrapping it all in one go. Obviously, charities, and obviously, I'm sure Megan, when you speak to her, will say, we need to scrap it all in one go. This will be, you know, much, much better for the economy, much better for the hundreds of thousands of children who are already in poverty.
And politically.